Hello, folks, and welcome to the August 28th edition of Dead Pit Radio. I'm the Creepy Kentuckian.
And I am Uncle Bill.
And boy, do we have a treat for you this week, folks, because you know that Cher song? If I could turn back time, if I could find a way,
I'd show my ass to a bunch of sailors, and they'd say,
what the fuck's wrong with your goddamn daughter?
You're 57 years old, put some fucking clothes on.
No, they'd say, what's wrong with your daughter, goddammit? She's a girl. She's wanting a dick now.
She wants a dick put in a vagina, and not in a good way. She wants it put in for her vagina.
I know a little bit later on, we're going to be talking about The Faces of Death. Because that came out in 78.
You going to talk about that Traces of Death where they had the sex chains operation?
Do you remember, do you see that?
Yes, yeah. Unfortunately, I saw it. I could never unsee it.
Where they turned a woman into a man, sort of. They used like extra flesh that they had around the leg to make something that sort of resembled a dick. It looked like a large Vienna sausage or something, though.
That's going to give me chills.
It didn't have a dick hole. I do remember that. It was just like a void piece of meat.
Yeah.
It really did look like a Vienna sausage or Vienna.
Vianney.
Vianney sausage with a buckle of all.
Oh, God.
So anyway, we're turning back time this week. As if Dead Pit exists in 1978, talking about the year that was. And this was a classic year when it comes to horror films, folks. And we're going to go through that in the big segment of the show coming up after the news.
Yeah, I don't know how many people realize this, but when we do these year in review shows, we really are thorough. I mean, of course people know about the big movies that came out in 1978, the Halloweens and the Dawn of the Dead and stuff like that.
And we do dedicate time to those
movies. Yeah, but you don't realize all the shit that came out in that year, I don't think. Like, there's a ton of stuff.
Yeah, we'll be going through it all, folks.
So also, stay tuned. After that, we've got DVD reviews. You gotta have that.
DVDs.
And this week is one of those weeks where it's going to be eclectic, to say the least. Because we've got one thing that doesn't have anything to do with anything else in the world, and then we've got a made-for-TV horror film. But the one that I brought is the brand-new WWE release of The Rise and Fall of WCW, where it's an hour and 45-minute long documentary about how it is that WCW came from, you know, relatively nowhere, was the biggest wrestling federation in the world, and fell completely fucking apart in the span of about a year.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to really talk about this, because as years go by and you don't have any competition for WWE at all, I mean, in a way, I realize, like, the last year of the company, they might as well already been gone, because it was just, it was horrible.
Well, the funny thing about that, I was thinking when I was watching it, is even the wrestlers and the promoters and stuff were saying that it sucks without competition.
Right.
That, like, you can't have wrestling without competition. And it does. I mean, that's why it's so horrible now, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that in great detail towards the end of the show. And we're also going to be taking your phone calls. I think we're going to talk briefly as well to Jeff Waldridge of the Scarefest, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. Pretty big show. I mean, this show last year was a huge surprise to me as far as how many people actually came out to it. You know, I know that. So hopefully it'll be more of the same this year, but we'll be talking to him. And, yeah, we might as well go ahead and get started. I don't think there's a whole lot of news this week, though, at least stuff that interests us to mention on the show, but we can go ahead and get started. Uncle Bill.
You ain't gonna mention Don't Be Afraid of the Dark?
Oh, yeah, we're reviewing Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just got so caught up in WCW. I didn't know what to do.
Okay, well, I guess the first news story we can talk about let me talk about Night of the Creeps, because I know that's something that a lot of people are waiting on, anticipating the release, of course, of the DVD and the Blu-ray of Night of the Creeps. And it's going to be October the 27th release date. Now, you got, as well as a director's cut of the film, Each release, the DVD and the Blu-ray, will contain commentary with writer-director Fred Decker, a cast commentary, featurettes including Birth of the Creeps, Cast of the Creeps, Creating the Creeps, Escape of the Creeps, Legend of the Creeps, and Tom Atkins' Man of Action, the original theatrical ending, deleted scenes, and a trivia track. I mean, this is probably one of the most stacked DVD and Blu-ray releases that I've seen in a fortnight. So, should be good.
Yeah, and they did release the final cover art for... actually separate cover art for the DVD and the Blu-ray. And I think the Blu-ray definitely has the better cover art of the two.
The DVD looks like fucking Hulk Hogan Circle, like Pasta Mania. It looks like...
I have no clue what they were thinking with the DVD covers on this. Like, with Monster Squad, at least, I could tell they were trying to make it like Harry Potter or something, you know, more modern that maybe more audiences would get. What the fuck were they trying with Night of the Creeps? Like, what were they going for?
It looks like they were going for, let's put something out there that looks so fucking bizarre that it'll just draw people's attention. Because you don't really see that many DVD covers that are yellow with, like, red inlay and stuff. It just looks horrible. Yeah. Like, I guess if you saw that, you'd have to be like, just for a second, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, I don't know what to think about that. I think we should probably have Slipcase on here before at least the DVD comes out. We'll ask him what he thinks of the cover. Of course, I don't know if he'll give us an honest answer since he's, you know, working on the DVD and stuff itself, but at least the movie is coming out, and he's doing a lot of really good features on it. It's going to be in HD as well as DVD, so... definitely look forward to that. Also coming to DVD on November 17th from Lionsgate is Train, Gideon Raft's quasi-remake of Terror Train, Uncle Bill.
Terror Train!
Touring Eastern Europe with her college wrestling team, Alex, played by Thora Birch, who remember her massive boobs in American Beauty. Woo, baby, yeah! That's what I'm talking about.
I remember seeing her in a horrible fucking direct-to-DVD film that we watched not too long ago, too.
Yeah. Attends a debauched late-night party that causes her and her teammates to miss their train to Odessa.
Odessa, Texas!
Her coach is furious, but a mysterious woman offers the group a ride on an alternate train. The coach agrees, and the athletes, exhausted and hungover, gratefully climb aboard. However, this train harbors a deadly secret, and for Alex and her fellow passengers, a blood-soaked nightmare is just beginning, baby.
They gonna have Blackfoot on the soundtrack doing Train Train?
Yeah. This doesn't even sound like a fucking remake to Terror Train. So, I'm glad they're calling it Train. Like, although it's sort of stupid, like, you could call it Train of Evil or something, you know.
Yeah, you could. If you're
Train
gonna,
is just generic.
If you're going to do that, you can just name a movie. Here's the next movie coming out. It's called Box. Kitchen Table's coming out in October.
Yeah. It's just a generic fucking name, though. Lionsgate presents Train.
It's about a train.
Oh, shit.
It's going to scare the fuck out of you. Thor Butch ain't going to show a boobies a mess. Yeah. Next up, it'll be from producer Michael Bay. Table Lamp.
Oh! No, Table Lamp is too descriptive. It's got to be either Lamp or Table.
Yeah. Actually, Table Lamp is the sequel to Table.
Steven Summers, the man that brought you shitty-ass G.I. Joe and the Mummy 3. Presents Tree.
You better run, bitch. This tree's coming for you. It's a fucking tree with leaves on it.
So, yeah. Train.
I'm looking forward to seeing Train, though. Okay. How about Scream 4?
How about it?
Anna Lynn McCord, who is apparently on the show Nip Tuck, is said to have been offered a role in Dimension Films' sequel to Scream. Of course, Scream 4, the new one that's coming out. As reported, this will be a younger version of the early Scream films from the 90s and will kick off a whole new trilogy. Wes Craven! I knew it.
God!
Ladies and gentlemen, Wes Craven, baby! He hasn't ruled out the possibility of directing the film just yet, and I'd say that he probably will because they'll offer him a shitload of money to do it.
Yeah.
But you can look forward to Anna Lynn McCord, who I don't even know who the hell that is. She's going to be in the film.
You don't know who Anna Lynn McCord is?
No. Apparently, Nev Campbell's not ever going to come back because she's busy. She's doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, she's doing a lot of... I think she's the ticket taker on Broadway right now.
Yeah. And that's not in the play ticket taker. She's really
she's a ticket taker.
Yeah.
Thank you. Enjoy the show. We're going to take a break. We will be back after Beck.
To the future.
Hello, everyone. I'm Adam Beck, and you're listening to Beck to the Future. Historically, this has to be one of the worst weeks ever when it comes to horror releases. This week, back in 1992, Paramount released the Mary Lambert film Pet Sematary 2, starring John Connor, the human resistance leader, and Gilbert from Revenge of the Nerds.
Hey, what are you doing?
Getting things ready for Mom.
Mom is dead, Jeff.
She doesn't have to be.
Definitely one of my guilty pleasures, the film opened in 1,852 theaters, taking in $4.8 million and debuting number 3 at the weekend box office. In 1997, a cross-dressing Leatherface graced the silver screen when Lionsgate released Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 23 theaters.
You want a beer? Have a look behind you.
A long night, boy.
This Kim Hinkle abomination took in just $53,000 and left horror fans scratching their head asking the simple question, why? In 2001, John Carpenter hit a brick wall at 100 miles per hour when Sony released Ghost of Mars starring Ice Cube. The craptastic sci-fi horror film opened in 2,048 theaters and was a massive flop, coming in number 9 its opening weekend and ended with a worldwide gross of just $14 million total. In 2002, Warner Brothers released the ultra-scary Fear.com in 2,550 theaters. The movie opened number 5, taking in $5.7 million. The following year, convicted child molester and registered sex offender Victor Salva had his fantasies come true once again when he was able to direct a whole school bus filled with young, shirtless teenage boys during the 2003 filming of Jeepers Creepers Part 2.
It was love at first sight, truly love at first sight.
The film was released by United Artists in 3,124 theaters and opened number 1, taking in over $15 million its opening weekend. And finally, in 2004, Sony released the Anaconda sequel, Anacondas 2, The Hunt for the Blood Orchid. Even though this sounds like a horribly shitty sci-fi original movie, somehow this film actually made it to theaters, opening on 2,905 screens and debuting number 2 at the weekend box office, taking in nearly $13 million. Anyway, I'm Adam Beck, and this has been Beck to the Future for the week of August 24th.
Howdy, folks, and welcome back. I want to talk about a new movie from writer-director Ty West.
No!
Who, this guy did Cabin Fever 2, Spring Chickens, or whatever the hell it's called, Spring Fever.
Mm-hmm.
Funny story about that. They were supposed to secretly screen that at Fright Night Film Fest. It never happened because the disc broke. The one disc they had broke.
I guess there is a God after all.
I'm guessing that movie's God fucking awful. I could only guess.
Well, here's the thing. I can't imagine that it would be any worse than the original Cabin Fever, honestly.
Like, yeah, but the thing is, this thing's been done for like 2 years, and it's never, ever come out.
It just means it's really good. I mean, if they've been spending 2 years working on it, it's bound to be great, right? I mean,
anyway, that's what it always he's got happens. A new movie, a satanic thriller set in the 1980s. Starring Jocelyn Donahue, who was in
Phil
the Burrowers, which we reviewed, I think.
Yeah.
Greta Gerwig of Hannah Takes the Stairs and Baghead, starring Steve Dash.
Hannah Takes a Dump.
Yeah. Tom Noonan of the Monster Squad. I'm not going to mention Manhunter because that movie blows.
Sorry. A lot of people like that, though.
Mary Warnoff of The Devil's Rejects. A.J. Bowen of The Signal. And Dee Wallace of E.T. The film will premiere on Amazon, Xbox Live, and Video On Demand October 1st. And in, I'm guessing, really limited theaters on October 30th. The movie stars Sam, played by Jocelyn Donahue, who is a pretty college sophomore so desperate to earn some cash for a deposit on an apartment that she accepts a babysitting job even after she finds out there is no baby, Uncle Bill. There's no baby.
Holy shit.
Mr. and Mrs. Ullman are the older couple who lure Sam out to their creaky Victorian mansion deep in the woods just in time for a total lunar eclipse. Megan, played by Gerwig, is Sam's best friend who gives her a ride out to the house and reluctantly leaves her there despite suspecting that something is amiss. Victor, at first, seems like he's just a creepy guy lurking around the house, but quickly makes it clear that Sam will end this night in a bloody fight for her life.
Fight for your life! Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Fight for your money. No. That'd be a good movie.
I like the song, You gotta fight for your right to party.
Shut up.
Maybe it's set in the 1980s, goddamn, but that was a song to play.
I was thinking, though, that sounds like it'd be a good movie for Dusty Rhodes to be in. He could come in and be like, there ain't no baby in here, baby.
But I've seen the poster for this movie. This movie is House of the Devil. And they're going for a really retro vibe with this thing. So we'll just have to wait and see. I think Magnet is the ones doing the distribution on it. So we'll definitely get to review it whenever it comes out. So that's House of the Devil from Ty West, the guy that tried to bring you Cabin Fever 2.
He did bring
still
you.
Not out.
He brought you The Roost, which I've never seen.
I mean, never.
Okay. A guy that I always do like to keep up with because I've enjoyed pretty much all the films that I've seen him in. Simon Pegg is set to headline John Landis's latest horror film, Burke and Hare, which is lensing in London later this summer. Based on a true story, Burke and Hare is about two 19th century grave robbers who find a lucrative business providing cadavers for an Edinburgh medical school. Apparently the tagline of the film is, no job too small, no body too big, no questions asked. So I'm surprised Nick Frost is not going to be in that with him.
I am fucking shocked. This is Lensing in London.
It is, buddy. It's Lensing in London.
That sounds like a Scorpion song.
Lensing in London?
Yeah.
Go out to the last row! Lensing in London to Nick! I'm a Nazi! You ready for it? Let's do it real quick.
Big titty nights. Big titty nights. Big titty.
So, last thing I have here is Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell. The DVD and Blu-ray is coming out October the 13th, Uncle Bill. Pretty quick. Seems like that's coming out pretty quick. Like the movie itself came out, what, June?
Mm-hmm. They want to get it out real quick and cash in on it.
Yeah. The unrated Blu-ray comes with exclusive extra features. What do you think of that? Not on the DVD, including production video diaries, D-Box, and Blu-ray Live. My scene sharing, while the DVD comes with just the production video diaries, Uncle Bill. What do you think of that?
Oh, no!
Which features over 30 minutes of behind-the-scenes footage.
Fuck.
So, I actually liked Drag Me to Hell, but I didn't love it. I mean, it was like, it was a fun movie, but I wasn't marking out for it like everybody else was.
I was fucking...
Aw, shit. You didn't like it as much as me, I don't think.
I didn't like it at all, Bill. Well, I kind of...
It was fun. I mean, it had fun moments in it. It had very cheesy moments, remind you of 80s horror. But it wasn't like the big, you know, the next big thing that we're really looking for, I don't think.
It wasn't a movie that I thought was going to make or break like Sam Raimi's comeback, for sure. Here's a film, though, that I know that one person in particular on the board really, really loves, and they're apparently making a sequel to Heathers. I don't know how many people remember the original Heathers, but it was...
It's a movie that stars a bunch of people playing Heather.
Yeah. It's Christian Slater, Winona Ryder, and apparently Winona Ryder has been quoted as saying that she's in talks to star in the sequel.
Because well, she ain't
doing
nothing
else. Yeah. She ain't doing nothing else.
She just got out of prison.
But it says that she was quickly shot down by director Michael Lehman, who said that it would never happen, that Ryder was full of shit. So now it looks like Ryder was onto something, but probably not something she was hoping for. According to Variety, the 20th Century Fox is developing contemporary take on Heathers, which is just another way of basically saying that they're going to remake it. Yeah. So yeah, I thought they already remade it about 15 different times with Lindsay Lohan and shit, but apparently there's going to be another one. Anyway, they say that it's going to be remade as a television series, and the dark comedy will be adapted for TV by writer Mark Rizzo, with an assistant writing position by Sex and the City alumnus Jenny Bex.
Yay.
There's going to be a fucking Heathers TV show.
No, there's not. That'll never happen.
Awesome.
That'll never happen.
I don't know, man. What was that one thing they remade here for like television recently? I like to shit myself.
Gilligan's Island.
So stupid. Did they remake Gilligan's Island?
Yeah, they made it like a reality show. The real Gilligan's Island or something like that.
Oh, no.
What the fuck is
it? Oh, I know what it was. They brought back Beverly Hills 90210.
Oh, yeah. Now it's just simply called 90210.
Who the fuck would ever thought that would happen?
Yeah. And Shannon Doherty wasn't in it.
No, because Shannon Doherty's no bitch.
I noticed though somebody was saying that she was going to be at, like, what was that convention? Maybe the Spooky Empire show.
She is going to be at Spooky Empire, yeah.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to hear some stories from her. And regardless of, like, if she's a bitch or not, though, what the fuck does that have to do with horror movies at all? Like, was she ever in anything horror-related?
She was in that TV show Charmed. I know that. It's like...
You're going to be a fucking homo to like that shit.
Oh, you ask if there's anything horror-related, that's horror-related.
Jason Payne's probably sitting there at home with all the box sets. Oh, man, I got the new season of Charmed, dude. We'll watch that after I'm done watching Angel.
I really like Alyssa Milano, brother.
Why not?
Why not, dude?
So that's all I've got, though. I want to mention opening nationally this week is Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. Uncle Bill, what do you think of that?
No! Oh, God, no! That's what I think about it.
Yeah. You know, something is up, though. I was looking on Facebook. You know, some of the big... they like to think they're big wigs that live in L.A. and get to go to these premieres and stuff.
You mean the West Coast Elite?
Yeah, the West Coast Elite. They even have a hard time putting it over. So I'm just hoping for the worst with this movie.
Did you see the review? I didn't read the review. There's a full review with spoilers and everything in it that was posted on the board recently. I didn't read anything about what happens in the movie. But needless to say, the guy that did the review said that he absolutely loved the original Halloween remake. And he said that it was like the biggest piece of shit. One of the biggest pieces of shit he'd ever seen.
Well, see, in a lot of ways, though, that could be the opposite with us. You know, maybe it could be the Devil's Rejects of the Halloween movies.
It could.
Oh, my God! He's after me again! Oh! Jesus Christ! Michael!
Halloween remake starring Jason Payne. Halloween 2 starring Jason Payne. Jesus Christ! Get me the fuck out of here! There's fucking Michael Myers!
Jason Payne didn't cuss.
Oh, that's true.
Get me the crap out of here, dude!
What the poop's going on?
I wish I was back in Fuck You, Oku, Japan! So, yeah, Halloween 2 opening nationally. Woo, baby, it's going to fuck. I got a feeling.
I'm looking forward to seeing it, though, because that's just one of those movies where it looks like it'll be something great to talk about, at least.
It'll be epic for us, because, you guys remember the last Rob Zombie Halloween. That was probably like one of our most popular on-the-road reviews ever, I think.
Yeah, it was pretty much like 30 minutes of us bitching. Was that all we got? I don't have anything else.
You got another nuts?
I do!
Talk about what other nuts come out.
September the 1st. There's only three things coming out according to this list. You got Supernatural, the complete fourth season on DVD and Blu-ray. You got Turner Classic Movies' Greatest Classic Films Collection, the Horror Edition that has Freaks, House of Wax, The Haunting, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'd like to really have that, actually. If I didn't already have Freaks, I wouldn't mind having the rest of those movies. And from Lionsgate, for some reason, there's just like an endless array of these one-shot serial killer movies. Drifter, the Henry Lee Lucas story. Oh,
it's Kane Hodder in that, too.
He probably is Henry Lee Lucas.
Yeah.
That's September the 1st, though, next Tuesday. Have fun.
Ever since Kane Hodder, got replaced as Jason, I think that he just wants to play every serial killer he can. I think that they actually cast him in the new, they're making yet another movie on Eileen Wuornos, and it's an independent one, and he's actually going to play her as well.
He could play her. Have you ever seen her?
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, she really does look like somebody that would be like, you burning fucking hell, Judge.
Yeah, she was a little nutty, and she looked like somebody from around here that's been on a crystal meth binge.
So, anyway, we're going to take a break, but we're going to be back and talk about the year that was 1978, Uncle Bill. We're going to go turn back the hands of time and pretend that it's all groovy and jiving and 69ing into the 70s.
Shut up!
Won't you shut up? Don't tell me to shut up, you cocksucker.
So let's go ahead and take a look.
I'll have a diarrhea explosion all over your face.
Take a look at 1978, the year in review.
After this break here on
deadbeat.com.
You know what, Uncle Bill?
Shut your fucking mouth right now.
No, I want to talk about Fast Custom Shirts.
Holy shit. Well, let's talk about it.
FastCustomShirts.com provides some of the best horror t-shirts I have ever fucking seen.
I don't think that you can really fully appreciate how awesome the t-shirts are over at FastCustomShirts.com until you go over to FastCustomShirts.com and look for yourself.
Yeah. The Hitman T-Shirt Joe. The highest quality of shirts that I've actually designed some of them, Uncle Bill. He actually lets the fans design some of the shirts for his site. Who else does that? Who else?
Nobody I know of. But when he's not busy playing with Carmen Opsy, he's busy cranking out some of the most high quality fucking shirts that you're going to find this side of any other damn whore t-shirt maker.
Yeah. So check him out. FastCustomShirts.com. The best there is.
The best there was.
And the best there ever will be.
It's a boot respect.
Take me now, baby, here as I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand the way I...
Hello, folks, and welcome to our special segment, The Year in Review, 1978, Uncle Bill. It'll be almost like we were doing the Dead Pit Radio Show back in the year, 1978, talking about all the movies that came out that year.
Well, that's fucking groovy, Daddy-O, and it was the year of disco and bell bottoms and have a nice day and all that stupid bullshit. Yeah.
And the Kiss Army, though, they were running wild.
You had two distinct factions of music back then. You had the the coming on of the really heavy, getting ready to turn into the metal stuff.
And oh, yeah.
The pop music, which was like the Carpenters and Seals and Croft and fucking disco and just the god-awful shit like that ever was. But
you also had the Southern Rock.
That's true. You also had what I consider to be a turning point in horror. You had two films that we're going to talk about that revolutionized and changed horror films forever. And this was in 1978. And you also had a bunch of stuff that didn't revolutionize shit. And we're going to be talking about all of it.
That's true. I actually think the Star Wars Christmas special came out in 1978.
It did. And it will never see the light of day on DVD as long as George Lucas is alive.
Yeah, but if you go to any convention throughout the country, you can find it.
I don't understand that. I mean, George Lucas embarrassed everybody enough with all those prequels. I mean, the least he could do was...
Yeah, you figure he would at least, like, remaster it and put Jar Jar Binks in it and shit.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
The world will never know. But we're going to run through a lot of the movies that came out that year. Some of them we haven't seen or we're not that familiar with, so we'll go through those rather quickly. Some of them we'll spend more time on. So let's go ahead and get started. What do you have first, Uncle Bill?
Well, I guess one of the first ones of note that we just recently watched probably did start like a whole trend of subgenre of films that we talk about quite a bit on here, which was Faces of Death. Faces of Death came out in 1978, and really, that film along with Snuff were like the beginnings of the Mondo shock, like real death style films. Right. And we just watched this film on Blu-ray probably
last year, I think, when it came out.
6 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of odd that this movie came out that long ago. I mean, considering some of the, like, a lot of it was really hokey, especially now, you know, like the scene I always remembered as a kid was the group gathering around a table eating a monkey's brain. But if you watch that now, that just looks so ridiculous. You know?
I was thinking, though, when we were watching that again, for that time period, man, I mean, that still, all that stuff still looked pretty good to this day. And for 1978, it was amazing. Like, I can completely see going back and watching that, how that fooled as many people as it did. Because they never showed too much. I think that was the key to that.
Right.
Like, they had a lot of cutaways, and they had a lot of stuff where they showed, you know, just enough to make you think, like the old Tom Savini adage, just enough to make you think that it happened. You don't show too much because that just makes people realize that it's a trick. But they showed enough that you really thought that was possible, that should happen.
And another thing you got to mention on here is they actually did show some real death tapes in this as well. I mean, they mixed it up.
Yeah, and they did a good job with that, too.
Which definitely helped with the audience believing it was real, I think. Because some of the stuff, just like a body washing up on a beach and stuff, I mean, there's no, you just can't fake that sort of thing, the detail in that sort of thing. And but, I mean, as far as Faces, Death, and the legacy it's had. I mean, look at all the knockoffs, you know, the death tapes, the traces of death, Death Faces was another one. Just tons and tons of knockoffs. And there were like at least five or six more Faces of Death movies made after this. They kept making them up until, you know, the 1990s, I think. So,
to me, though, those kind of movies are the equivalent of like the Blair Witch Project, where somebody just comes along and they do something that nobody really had ever even envisioned that people could do. And it shocks and just upsets so many people. But it works. Like, people are curious about that kind of stuff. They want to see that kind of stuff.
It's shocking.
It is.
It's brutal.
It sure is.
It's Faces of Death.
So, yeah, that inspired death metal bands for years to come.
Mm, indeed. Moving onward, though, a movie that is completely different than Faces of Death, and it spawned a ton of sequels as well, is The Ridiculous Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Yeah. Directed by John DiBello, who pretty much only did Killer Tomato movies. I was looking this guy up. I mean, it's definitely a comedy more than anything else, a black comedy. About Killer Tomatoes. It really is what it's, you know, it says it's about, and it's sort of fucking ridiculous.
I saw this film probably 15 years ago. I don't really remember that much about it, other than the fact that it's stupid as hell, and it's like a cult classic now. But other than that, I don't really remember that much about it.
I don't even know why it's a cult classic, though, to me. I mean, I remember a few years ago, we rented some videos, and they accidentally put Attack of the Killer Tomatoes in there. Do you remember this? And we tried to watch some of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so stupid, I had to turn it off. Or maybe it was one of the sequels. I don't know. Maybe
there's ones like, what is it? Return of the Attack?
Was there one with George Clooney in it?
Yes, there was. That's okay. I think Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
That might have been the one we were watching. Yeah, just the... Although these movies are fucking stupid. And, like, I like comedy and horror, but this is just fucking ridiculous, this shit was. You know, I mean, you'd have to just be completely retarded or something to get into this shit, I would think. Maybe like...
Oh, hold up there, buddy. We can't insult anybody else. We can't be talking about people.
Fucking crap, dude! Oh! Insult your fans and whatnot.
This is the reason why people are leaving your site in droves. You talk shit about your fans. I'm sorry. You talk poop about your fans.
Do-do-do-do-do. Take them Killer Tomatoes, in my humble opinion, sucks.
Yeah. Anyway, do you have anything else? Because I don't really know that much about that movie. That you want to add about Attack of the Killer Tomatoes?
It has some killer tomatoes in it.
They're killer.
They're brutal. They love to feast on the flesh of the living.
I just remember there's a scene in that movie where there's a huge tomato, and somebody's got like a cart underneath it, like a dolly. And they're just wheeling it down, like, to make it look like it's running. The tomato's running after somebody. They're just wheeling it along. And you can clearly see the wheels and shit. Well, that's good filmmaking right there.
John DiBello evidently has, you know, instead of a fear of the dark, he's got a fear of the tomato.
You remember that Maury episode where that woman had a fear of pickles?
Yeah.
Ah! Take the pickles away from me, Maury! They brought out a fucking jar of pickles.
Ah! They start screaming.
It's a pickle! Ah! They're going to wait till she goes to sleep to stick a pickle up her butt.
Maybe that's what John DiBello should do now. He should do Attack of the Killer Pickles.
Bring that woman in. Oh, God.
They could jam the pickles up your butt.
Okay, so moving on. And I don't even know how much... I don't know anything about this movie. I've never seen it, but you've seen it, so I figured it was a good thing to bring up. Devil Dog, The Hound of Hell.
Hound of Hell.
Came out in 1978.
Yeah. This is definitely a prime candidate for Creepy's Crappy Movie Reviews. Actually, it would be a great choice because the movie itself is about a killer German Shepherd. Actually, not just a killer German Shepherd, a possessed German Shepherd from hell, Uncle Bill. A devil dog, if you will. And,
I know, that's crazy!
Yeah. But this was a TV movie. This was made, of course, in 78. And stars Richard Crenna, who you may remember from Rambo. And his family gets this puppy. You know, this little German Shepherd puppy. And it, along the lines of, like, I know a movie we're going to be talking about, one of the Omen movies coming up. It's sort of like that, but with a dog. You know, and extremely shitty special effects. Like, there's a scene where the dog actually becomes the beast or whatever it's supposed to be, you know, the devil's dog, I guess. And, he actually has, like, horns come out of him, and it's just, like, you gotta see it to believe it. It is freaking hilarious. Like, some of the special effects in it. And I think that when they have the puppy, there's a scene where they do the eye trick, you know, with superimposed shit, similar to they did with, what was it, Children of the Damned or something like that. And it just looked fucking ridiculous.
Don't they have to, they had to pause in Children of the Damned, like you couldn't be moving. So they had to pause the still picture.
I think what it was, yeah, they took a still photo of the dog and just like showed its eye. And it was like the cutest little dog ever. And they tried to make it look, you know, like it was evil by just fixing the eyes like that. And it's, yeah, you definitely need to see that movie.
I know that that movie comes in a 3-pack along with Grizzly, which is a William Girdler joint, and Day of the Animals, which is another William Girdler film.
Let me tell you this. By far, it's the best movie in that 3-pack. By far. So
yeah, Devil Dog, the
Hound of Hell. Kim Richards who is the twin sister of Kyle Richards from Halloween, is actually in this movie as well, as a little girl who, of course, wants the dog. So I would highly recommend this movie as far as just one of those movies that's so bad it's hilarious. It'd be a great movie to enjoy with friends, you know, if you want to laugh and have just a, you know, a fun old time, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, any of the killer animal movies I'm always for. We'll be talking about another one of those here in a little while. But we're also going to talk about this, since you mentioned it, Damien, Omen 2 with William Holden and Lee Grant. And this is the one where Jonathan Scott Taylor plays Damien in this film. And he's in a military school now. He's being raised by a wealthy, to-do aunt and uncle, I believe. And this is... He's probably, what, a teenager in this film?
Yeah,
or maybe
young,
a preteen?
Young teenager.
Yeah. And the thing I always remember about this movie is I think I like this one as much as I did The Omen, really.
Yeah. For some reason, The Omen 2 was one of those movies that I remember more from it than I did from the original movie, you know, as a kid, because there was a lot of really cool scenes in The Omen 2. Like, the big thing in The Omen 2 that I remember is Damien really learns who he is in this one, you know. And there's also some horrific death scenes in this one, too. Like, I think in the first one it was a crazy dog, right, that sort of helped Damien commit some of these acts. And in this one it's a crow, or it's like a black bird,
right,
or something,
yeah,
like that, that causes a lot of the havoc. And there's a scene where a lady gets run down by an 18-wheeler or something like that that's really effective. And I thought the movie was really well made, too, well shot. A lot of it's in the wintertime. And I don't know if it was shot in England, but it definitely had an English look to it.
It's one of those movies, though, where the music probably plays as much a part as in any other movie I've ever seen. Maybe like another one we're going to talk about plays more of a part, but the Jerry Goldsmith score in this film, everybody remembers that score. And whenever anything's getting ready to happen associated with Damien in the film, that score comes in, and it's just the creepiest damn thing ever. Like, I don't know who had the idea of using like chanting and Latin, but it adds like a whole new dimension to it that you would never have without that. But yeah. The thing I remember about the first film was the death scene where the woman's hanging up the plant,
yeah,
on the railing, and Damien comes around.
Damien actually accidentally knocks her over, it seems like.
Right, but there's not really anything accidental in this movie from what I remember.
Yeah, I mean, once, you know, teenage Damien learns of his powers, you know, he uses them. You know, no one must tell the secret that he is, you know, the devil reincarnated or whatever, or the son of the devil, whatever, you know. But I think this movie's really effective, and I really like this movie quite a bit. I mean, I sort of agree with you that it is. I like it just as much, if not better, than the original Omen. And I think that the kid that played Damien in this did a really, really good job as well.
Yeah, props to him. That's Jonathan Scott Taylor in his film.
You got to remember, Damien in the first movie was really just a little kid that he didn't really speak that. I don't think he spoke at all, did he?
He may have, but I don't remember.
More than maybe one or two words. And I know that one little fit where he started screaming like a bitch when he was coming close to the chapel or whatever, you know.
So what do you got?
So. The next one I want to talk about, let's go ahead and talk about this one since we were talking about William Girdler earlier. And we did review this movie a couple of years back when it came out on DVD. It is The Manitou, or The Manitou. And this is definitely one of the silliest plots I have ever, especially when you finally.
I fucking love this movie, though.
When it's finally revealed, what happens in this is hilarious. William Girdler, I think that this was his last movie, wasn't it?
The last movie
he directed, I believe. I believe it was. I'm not paused. I'm not a Girdler-holic.
You're going to...
Jason Payne and whatnot. Oh, dude.
You're going to incur the wrath if you don't watch out. You stupid idiot.
William Girdler made 15 other movies after that.
You bunch of crap heads.
I'm going to kick your ass all the way over here and fuck you, Oku, Japan, whatnot.
He's in Funaki, Japan right now, by the way.
He's in Kung Funaki, Japan. So, yeah. I mean, the whole thing in, I think it's, what was her name? Susan Strasberg.
Mm.
Her character finds a lump on her back, pretty much.
Yeah. Turns out to be a fucking midget Indian.
And it's growing at a rapid rate.
Oh, God.
And then I remember towards the end, it's almost like they go into outer space or something.
It is, man. That ending to that film is like a bad acid trip or something. It's like the film goes straight all the way up to that ending, and like at the end where they have to fight the, you know, the supernatural aspect of it, it really turns into like a 1960s, you know, one of those party rock acid movies like The Wall or something from Pink Floyd.
But ultimately, like, you find out it's a 400-year-old demonic Native American midget.
Which is hilarious. Like, when they go in there to fight it, and there's a little, like, it's supposed to be like a threatening Native American midget running around.
Here's the thing. Why can't it just be a Native American? Why did it have to be a Native American midget?
Well, it was going to be a regular Native American, but it was still in the developmental phase. So it's still a midget. Well, it just shot out of her. It's going to grow, I think.
So the midget, actually, the limbs grow on the midget.
Right.
The midget was Felix Sela, who was Cousin It.
It was a seedling at the time, I think.
Felix Sela, like, I'm sure he was an Ewok, too.
You know he was. That's where all those guys got their start. Anyway, though, this movie, like, I'm a huge fan of, like, the body horror movies where people, like, find something's wrong with their body and then it turns out to be something, like, supernatural. Like, Cronenberg did that shit all the time. And I'm a big fan of anything like that. And this movie is no exception. Like, this plays on the old urban legend of, like, the spiders nesting in your ear. Or when you find something that is wrong with you and you think it's going to be something just, you know, kind of normal, nonchalant bump or something like that, and it turns out to be something horrific that eventually sprouts out of you, and in this case it just happens to be a fucking Indian.
Yeah. The movie, I gotta admit, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the movie, but when the big unveiling happens, it is hilarious.
I couldn't stop laughing
at how ridiculous it was. And it was like he was taking it seriously, too. I mean, it wasn't like he meant for it to be funny. Like, I don't know if William Girdler was, like, just toking it up when he was making this movie, which is probably what happened. Or if he was just insane, you know, because I don't know anybody else that would think of something that ridiculous.
I don't either, but it works, though, because he doesn't play it as comedic, and it is so obviously hilarious that that's the way the best cult films are made, really.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine anybody writing to a script that ultimately what's going to come out of this woman is, like I said, a demonic Native American midget from hundreds of years ago, okay? I can't picture anybody actually coming up, let alone a studio, at the time I think it was a big studio, releasing the damn thing and thinking, oh shit, this is killer, we gotta do this, 400-year-old demonic Native American midget.
Yeah, back in 78, I'm sure somebody was like, you know what we should do? Instead of working on these old shitty movies that we got coming out right now, we ought to work on that midget Native American movie.
So, it's the Manitow, whatever you want to call it. Anchor Bay Entertainment has that one out on DVD, and you can get it really cheap, because I don't think it was one of their best sellers, to be honest with you.
It should be, though. Anyway, let's talk about a film that I think me and you are probably a little bit more split on, too. The more that I watch this film, the more that I just don't think it's that great of a film, but it is very influential. It's I Spit on Your Grave.
Mm. Yeah, starring Camille Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
Directed
by Mir Zarchi.
Zarchi.
Yeah, Zarchi.
Camille Keaton plays a writer in this movie who goes on a weekend retreat, I guess, to write, of course, working on a book.
Thus the writer.
Yeah, and she is out, what is she, swimming or sunbathing or something like that?
I think she is sunbathing, yeah.
And a lot of local yokels come along and brutally rape her. No. What is it, about a day later? She comes and she's ready for revenge.
Well, this is a take, really, on movies like Deliverance, where somebody's just, you know, out there minding their own business, and somebody comes along, like the locals come along and fuck with them, and in this case, they rape her. And then, like, the next, I don't even know if it's the next day or if it takes a while, but she gets to the point where
it's a little while, yeah. She sort of, she cleans herself and sort of heals up. I don't know how long the period is where she actually goes back and...
She's trying to bait them is basically what she's doing. Like, she's out wearing, you know, skimpy outfits and little to nothing, trying to get them to come back. And once they realize that she's not told the police or anything, they think that, you know, there must be something wrong with her. She's a nympho or something like that. So they come back, and there's one guy that has some remorse about it, and then the other ones are, like, completely, you know, they don't care. They just want to have their kicks and all that stuff. And one by one, she kind of picks them off.
In very sadistic ways. You know, there's a lot of this movie that is forgettable, I would say. I think that there's a lot of stuff coming out like this around this time. I think this movie in particular was sort of inspired by Last House on the Left a little bit. But there's one scene in this movie that always makes me cringe. And I'm sure a lot of you guys, if you've seen this movie, you know what scene that is. I guess the main bad guy in the movie, the lead villain, who she lures back to her house, her rental house, and, you know, promises some relations, baby. Oh. So she gets him in the bathtub. And, like, what's so effective about this scene is... Like, okay, she cuts the guy's dick off, pretty much. At first, he doesn't even notice it, though. And then he looks down and you see blood coming up. That's just wrong, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's just fucking foul. But I thought that was a really effective scene. I'll give him that.
Yeah. To me, it's not quite as effective as having your dick bitten off, like in Last House on the Left, but still... It's anything that has to do with messing with somebody's dick. It's just not right.
It's true.
So,
although in a lot of the Italian movies, it was a lot more graphic with the dick. You actually see the dick coming off.
That's true. Like any of those cannibal movies, there's always somebody hacking off a dick. Like somewhere like within an hour into the movie, somebody's dick's going to get hacked off.
Them crazy Italians love hacking on dick.
They sure do.
Almost as much as you.
Oh, fuck you. So... I was going to add something to that. What the hell was it now? As far as like the rape revenge movies, there's another one that's very little known and a lot less known than that movie that I like better, which is Miss 45. It's the exact same story, but it's just the way that it was directed and the cinematography and stuff I like a lot better. Especially I like the ending a lot better too. But this is the one everybody really remembers as far as those rape revenge styles.
Something else that helped the movie a lot, too, was the title. The title's very memorable when you, see a movie on the shelf called, you know, I Spit on Your Grave. I mean, that's pretty hardcore.
It's so memorable
that, time, you know?
that movie title's been ripped off at least a dozen times. There's I Piss on Your Grave.
I Spit on Your Corpse, I Piss on Your Grave.
There was another one, too. It's kind of similar to that. I'm surprised there hadn't been one called I Shit on Your Grave yet.
I Shit on Your Chest.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Sideways.
So that's I Spit on Your Grave, I Poop on Your Soul.
The next one I think would be a logical progression, talking about these movies. Mountain of the Cannibal God, Uncle Bill. That came out in 78, but that's one of my favorite cannibal movies.
I knew that was coming, too.
And it's a lot like all the other cannibal movies, really.
Is this the Ursula Anderson, Stacey Keach? Jesus Christ. You ever, like, watch a movie and then there's just certain scenes, you can't remember anything else about the movie, but there's scenes that are burned into your mind for the rest of your life. And this is one of those movies where the only thing I think of when I think of that movie is pig fucking.
Because it turned you on. That's what's got you into pig fucking, Uncle Bill. Seeing that guy fuck that. What was it?
I don't know what it was.
That was like a boar or something. That thing was like 400 pounds.
It looks like one of those things from Empire Strikes Back. It was fucking
you know what made it more effective, though, than anything, is it really looked like that guy was fucking that pig.
I hate to speculate, but I think that guy might have been fucking that pig.
Yeah.
Which I hope that guy got an extra couple hundred dollars for fucking a pig on camera.
But he probably liked it.
Another scene in that movie, though, too, where, like, there's a midget in it that, like, somebody crushes his head or something.
Yeah, there's a scene where one of the people that's held captive by the cannibals, there's actually a midget cannibal that comes down just to fuck with him or something. And then, like, the guy just kicks at the little midget, and the midget just falls back, and, like, half the back of his head comes off.
It was awesome.
I was like, I didn't know that could happen. If you just fell back and hit your head, that half your fucking head could come off.
Yeah.
It looked like they put, like, raw chicken livers and shit in the fake skull or something.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but this movie, like, of all the cannibal movies, it's sort of like the Troll 2 of cannibal movies. Like, there's just so much really bad stuff in this.
It's another one of those movies, too, where you can tell they were trying to be serious, too.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't even kidding around with the pig fucking and the heads exploding.
And this was one, too, that I think this movie is public domain now, oddly enough.
If I'm not mistaken, is this... It's got a couple of different titles, doesn't it? It's not just...
Slave of the Cannibal Gods, another one that's called... hell, I don't know. There's probably a lot more of them that's translated from Italy over. I don't know.
But
I always knew it as Mountain of the Cannibal Gods. I think Anchor Bay has that one out as well, or had that out in like a double feature and a regular edition. But yeah, Ursula Andress, who was in like a lot of shit like that.
She's in a James Bond movie as well, though. I think it was Dr. No.
I don't know anything about James Bond. But she was in like a lot of the Italian stuff. And Sergio Martino actually directed this movie, who did Torso as well. And he's still doing stuff today. He's done all kinds of shit.
Well, I gotta say, after watching Torso here recently, I think that he did a much better job on Torso than he did on that. But what can you really do with a cannibal movie with Stacy Keach? I mean, you're pretty much handcuffed right there.
Well, all the cannibal movies, though, like, I think they all just tried to rip off Cannibal Holocaust. That was just the point of making those cannibal movies. Like, at that time... of course, Cannibal Holocaust, no way. When the fuck did Cannibal Holocaust come out? I don't even know if it came out. Maybe it did. What year did that one come out?
I thought it came out in 80.
It might have. Right here, motherfucker. This is Mountain of the Cannibal God. This is the Godfather of cannibal movies.
I think The Man from Deep River is like the Godfather of cannibal movies. But
there was another one, Jungle Holocaust. That was... Yeah.
But anyway, the bottom line is that... there was a huge, like, cannibal war between Deodato and Umberto Lenzi. And really, all these other movies that came in there were just trying to cash in on that shit anyway. So it was between those two guys the whole way.
Yeah. I'm sure Umberto Lenzi and Ruggero Deodato talked over the phone bitching each other out. Hey, I come up with cannibal movie before you.
Hey, fuck you, buddy. I come up with better cannibals.
My movie invented the dung cutting baklava.
And then Sergio started going, hey, fuck you too. It would be a pig fucking in mine.
Then the Rosella Drury coming in.
Hey, let me tell you something, buddy. Fucking yeah. I'm going to kick in your fucking ass for talking about the man and my husband like a day.
And then they all ate baklava out of each other's buttholes.
Yeah, so that is, of course, yeah, Mountain of the Cannibal God.
So, we're going to take a complete 180 shift here and head into a film that was the highest grossing horror film of the year 1978. Believe this or not, this was the highest grossing horror film of that year. Jaws 2, which...
Just when you thought it was safe to get back in the water.
I was
going
to say, which has the best tagline of any film, I think, in the history of anything. But, as a... sequel, of course, was an inferior product to Jaws, because I don't think you could really ever top Jaws.
Yeah, I mean, the odd thing about Jaws, too, is they pretty much just tried to do the exact same fucking thing.
A lot of people say, though, that Jaws 2 is almost like a slasher film, like set to, in water with a shark instead of like a killer.
Well, I think that it seems that way because they didn't have Steven Spielberg making the movie again. I mean, the concept of Jaws itself is really a slasher movie, but you got to have, you know, if you have talent behind it, a guy that can actually make the story flow well, you know, like Spielberg, you know, it just seems like a great movie first, and then you'll think what genre it's in, you know.
Yeah, and plus, I think that film, Jaws 2, was really hurt by the fact it didn't have Dreyfuss and it didn't have Robert Shaw. I mean, to me, those three guys made up that movie, and their interaction was probably, like, the best part of that movie to me. And then right. This time you just got Roy Scheider, who's, I don't think he's a guy that can hold a movie together. And
right.
It's basically, like, two different films. It's, like, the stuff with him, with Roy Scheider trying to tell, like, warn people again that there's a fucking shark. That, and this is stretching it a bit thin, that they would be, like, trying to reopen this place when the exact same shit's happening again.
Well, I think the whole thing starts with that there's a crew actually going and trying to find remnants of the boat from the first movie.
Right.
And then, I don't know if it's implied that it's actually Jaws' offspring. I think it is.
Yeah.
Of course, they kill the crew, and then... Yeah, similar to a slasher movie. One by one, they're picked off. Jaws 2, and any of the sequels after that, in my opinion, it's sort of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They never needed to be made, you know? I mean, the whole point of them making the sequels, of course, any sequel is making money. I mean, but this series in particular, like, you're going to have, I think the guy's name was Jeanette Zwar, who directed the movie. Who the fuck is that? You're going to go from Steven Spielberg to Jeanette Zwar.
Well, it just goes to show you that even back then, those movies made a ton of money. But like I was saying, though, it's really two different films. It's the Roy Scheider stuff, and then it's the stuff with like Keith Gordon and that whole group of kids on the boats where they get stranded out, you know, and Jaws is kind of picking them off.
Right.
And they're all out there in the boats, and it's Roy Scheider's trying to get back there because his son's out there and all that stuff. I always liked the ending of the film, the way they did away with the Jaws. I don't know why, but I always thought that was pretty cool. But I don't know. It's just an okay film in my mind. Like, I don't hate it, but I don't really think it's great.
Yeah, I've went back. I've got, like, three of the four Jaws movies on DVD. Every once in a while, I'll go back and watch Jaws. I've never had the need to go back and watch any of those other movies. I just never have. I mean, you see them, I've watched them each one time. I don't even know why I watched Jaws of Revenge once, to be honest with you. God damn, that movie sucks.
I'd like to see Jaws of Revenge again.
Would you?
Yeah. Just because I
see Mario Van Peebles' Jamaican accent.
Hello,
hey,
man.
Mom, I'm Mario Van Peebles. You can watch me in New Jack City, essay.
Essay, is he? Fucking Jamaican or Mexican?
He's like Jamaican Mexican.
He's like, I'm from the beach, boy.
I do want to drink some Jamaica vodka or something sweet.
It all goes back to the Mexican guy.
We don't need Jaws and Revenge is another show.
Yeah, that'll be soon, I'm sure.
So, all right, let's get into some good stuff though. You know, I know that, you know, we've been giving you some filler here and there, talking about, of course, the Man of Tao, Mountain of the Can of God, stuff like that. I think a movie that today works and is just as effective now as it was when it came out, you know, and I can't really say the same for the Jaws movies, to be honest with you.
How dare you?
Is a movie made by John Carpenter, Uncle Bill. Oh, yes, it was made by John Carpenter. He's really young when he made this movie. Really low-budget movie. I'm talking about Halloween.
You talking about Halloween?
I'm talking about Halloween. John Carpenter's Halloween, starring Jamie Lee Curtis, Donald Pleasance, Nancy Loomis, P.J. Souls, Nick Castle as the Shape. Yeah, that's right. Nick Castle was the Shape, Tony Moran. Not you. Fucker.
So, whenever I think about Halloween, I just think, okay, bottom line, above anything else, there is a guy that understands how to make a film, John Carpenter. Okay? I think that at that point in his career, he could pretty much make a film about anything. It just happened to be that he chose a horror film to do. And that, you don't, if you have somebody that understands how to make a film, and understands how to make a film suspenseful, and knows great cinematography and great music, then all that other stuff will fall into place.
Right.
And the fact that it just, everything in that film worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from Jamie Lee Curtis to Donald Pleasance being in it, to the music being right, to the blue tint of the cinematography.
Cinematography itself, yeah. I mean, there's only a few movies I can think of where, you know, a few key elements, had they been taken out, the movie would have entirely sucked, you know. And the music is one for Halloween, and I think the cinematography, man, I mean, that to me, that's what makes the movie even creepier, is just the way it's shot and all the, you know, like you were saying, the blue coloring, the movie, and the movie, that is what really sets the mood in a movie. And it's like we were saying, I mean, back when Rob Zombie's Halloween was coming out, I don't give a fuck who made the remake. What is the point? You can't improve upon perfection. This movie, in my opinion, is perfect in every way. I mean, there's nothing I would change about the movie at all, even 31 years after it came out. I mean, how many movies can you really say that about, to be honest? I mean, I think a lot of people would agree with me that it's just, it's aged perfectly. It looks great, as good now as it did back then. The Blu-ray edition, I highly recommend everybody going out, if you got a Blu-ray player, and get the Blu-ray edition from Anchor Bay. To me, it showcases the cinematography and stuff even better, you know, than the versions you've seen before.
Mm-hmm. One thing I will say, too, about John Carpenter in that film was he really understood the need to have some sort of a faceless representation of, like, a universal fear, which is where I think that a lot of filmmakers go wrong today. They just throw a mask and shit on anything. Like, you got Valentine with that fucking Cupid mask. And
so, my nose bleeds over here!
But for him, it wasn't, everything I've ever heard him say, the mask was only really secondary. He wasn't trying to market a fucking mask or market a concept as much as he was trying to say, this is like a force, an entity, something that really has no human characteristics that you can kind of point out. It just is. Yeah. It's just this thing, you know,
I think
won't stop.
One of the best parts of our interview with John Carpenter, when he was describing that there's really only two types of horror movies. There's only two types of movies that he has made. And I can't really describe it like he did, but I remember him saying that the horror movies to him, the ones that he have made, have always been either two things, the evil out there or the evil inside, you know. And I think he was saying something like it was going back to a lot of the stories that Native Americans would tell around the campfire, you know, and things like that, that there's either somebody in the group that's out to get us, or there's somebody out of the group, you know, someone outside. And if you really look at all of John Carpenter's horror movies, they've really all been sort of like that, you know. And it's sort of interesting to me, and I've always thought of that part of the interview, because Halloween itself, like, I mean, that's the big problem with Rob Zombie's Halloween. And it would have been the problem with anything, because, you know, they've made so many goddamn Halloween movies now, who gives a shit? But the original Halloween was, it's just simply evil, you know, like, Donald Pleasant said, there's an evil out there coming to get you. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, and that's the thing that makes, in my opinion, Halloween such a rewatchable movie. And it's just, yeah, I mean, the first time, nobody can deny, the first time we saw this movie, it scared the shit out of you, pretty much, you know.
Well, the thing I was thinking, too, everybody is scared of the boogeyman at some point or another in their life. But what is that? What the hell is the boogeyman? And for everybody, it's something different. What the genius in what he did was, he said, all right, here's this thing you can, like, project anything you want to onto it. It can be anything. I mean, it doesn't have a face. You can put anything in there that you want to have in there. And that's what makes, to me, that's what makes that movie scary as hell still this day.
Yeah, and also, like, if you really look at the beginning of Halloween, too, and go back to what Carpenter said, I mean, Michael Myers started out as a part of the group, you know, and killed his sister, was locked up for, you know, what, 15 years, and just decided to break out on Halloween, you know. I mean, that's just a great idea, great concept. Everybody's talked about Halloween a million times, but in my opinion, it's probably my favorite horror movie and definitely deserves, you know, all the accolades it gets, I think.
Yeah, and that movie to me is always going to be a testament to what can happen if you have a really talented guy who has some really good ideas and an independent film, which it was an independent film, and you don't need really gore or a lot of violence. You just need a really good idea and somebody that can execute it. And that really was what that movie was.
Hell, and look at all of the Halloween movies since. All of them since have been big studio pictures. None of them have been as effective as the original.
That's very true. So we could probably spend the whole show just talking about that film.
But we must move on, oh yes.
Let's go back to some stuff that's a little less, I guess, iconic.
Some shittier stuff.
Yeah, some shittier stuff. But actually, this movie's not really shitty. It's actually pretty good. It's just got a strange concept. I think you
don't like shit dipped in shit.
I think you watched it recently, though, which was Magic.
Oh, yeah. I don't even have Magic down here. Yeah, we reviewed Magic back when it came out, I think. And, like, when I first read about the movie, and this movie stars Anthony Hopkins, of course. He is pretty much the only guy in the movie throughout most of the movie. I was thinking along the lines of Child's Play, something like that, you know, where it's really a killer doll.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing in Magic is Anthony Hopkins has just gone nutty. And he uses this doll as his alternate personality that actually kills people.
It's kind of like Mr. Hat. Yeah. Mr. Garrison.
What the fuck ever happened to Mr. Hat, anyway?
I don't know. That's a great idea, though. Which is kind of the same idea that's in this movie, which is this guy kind of blames everything that he does on this fucking puppet.
Yeah.
And the puppet talks to him. And
really creepy fucking puppet, too.
Yeah. It's not really like a puppet master kind of movie. Don't go into it thinking that that's what it's going to be, because it's definitely not that. But it's a very entertaining character study, and it's got Anthony Hopkins in it, and even back then he was a great actor.
Yeah.
And I was just watching him again, you know, in Silence of the Lambs. Hey, to me, that stuff like that, performances like that are amazing. And even back to Magic, he was just, you really believe that the guy has really unhinged.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few actors out there that anything they're in, pretty much, I mean, they just captivate you. I mean, you watch them and they're like, wow, I mean, that guy really, you can't really study to be that good. You just either have it or you don't. And there's a few guys like that. I mean, Robert De Niro, I would consider him like that as well, but God, he's done some shitty fucking movies in the last few years.
He has, and he does have a reputation for playing the same role over and over again, which I do agree with. But he plays that role really, really great, so I'd keep fucking doing it, too, if I was him.
Yeah. But I don't know. What else can you say about Magic, really? I think, I don't know if anybody else besides Anthony Hopkins could have pulled that off and made it, because this is pretty much a serious movie throughout. I mean, just like I guess you would call it an early psychological thriller type of movie, you know. I think Burgess Meredith was in this, too, wasn't he?
I think so. And I think, wasn't it Blue Underground that released it recently?
I think it was Dark Sky Films.
Was it Dark Sky? Okay, one of those.
So check that. Yeah, I like Magic quite a bit, actually.
Okay, so what else we got?
Well, we could talk about Piranha.
Roger Corman production. Directed by, I believe, was it Joe Dante?
Joe Dante.
Yeah.
I think one of the earlier movies, this was made in like we were saying, late 70s. So it was definitely one of his early big budget. Well, I don't know if it was a big budget, but early big budget.
Yeah, I don't think anything by Roger Corman was ever a big budget, to be honest. But This is a really cool story about a group of scientists who are working in this kind of laboratory above this river. I believe it's a river. Is it a lake? It's a river or a lake. I don't remember which. But they're working to genetically alter these fish and these piranhas and stuff. And as things happen to do, they get loose into this river.
Loose of the goof.
And it leads down in to where, you know, there's a group of people that are doing inner tubing and boating and stuff like that. And, of course, the piranhas.
Chest shitting.
Yeah. Olympic chest shitting. The piranhas go nuts and have a feast.
I remember this being a really, really low-budget movie, though, and I haven't seen it in many years, so I can't really talk about it too much, but I know they're remaking it, of course.
Yeah, Alexander Aja is hooked up to direct the Piranha 3D remake, which I'll never be able to understand any logic behind that, other than the fact that you can put 3D on behind anything now.
Alexander Aja just must really love snails.
Snails?
Yeah. He likes to eat them. They're expensive, so he needs the money to buy snails to eat.
I thought there was something coming there. He's going to stick them up his butt or something. I didn't know what was coming.
It probably tastes like something. It'd be stuck up your butt.
But I don't really. I mean, I've watched Piranha a couple of years back. Don't really remember that much about it. I know Belinda Blasky's in it, and she was in a ton of stuff that Joe Dante did, but.
So that's Piranha. God damn it. Let's talk about what I know you want to talk about it, so let's go ahead. We don't have much else.
Well, let me mention a couple more that we won't talk about, but that did come out that year. And either I haven't seen these, or we haven't seen these, or we just don't have that much to say about them. The Fury, that came out.
Brian De Palma joint.
Yeah. Kirk Douglas, I believe, was in that one. You've got Toolbox Murders, the original Toolbox Murders, which I haven't ever seen the original.
I've got that on VHS, not DVD.
You've got Invasion of the Body Snatchers came out that year, and I've got that on DVD, but I've never really watched it. That's one of those. People will probably fucking kill me for saying that, but I haven't. Also,
it's a remake, though. Fuck
it. It is, yeah. Also, Tourist Trap, which I've seen, but I don't think you've seen, with Chuck Connors, which is a great film, but it's like one of those films that's so weird that you'll have half people get it and half people will hate it. It's like a combination ghost story mixed with like a off-the-road, deserted, tourist trap that's where there's a crazy Chuck Connors, crazy guy played by Chuck Connors. Crazy Chuck Connors probably the same thing, who picks people off one by one that gets stuck there.
Indeed.
So the one, that we're leading up to, though. My favorite horror film. Probably, in my opinion, the best film ever made.
You know, we did.
I'm not kidding. People think I'm kidding.
You know, we did, though. Do a commentary about this movie, but other than that, I don't know if we've ever really talked about it too much on the show.
Dawn of the Dead, folks. Dawn of the Dead came out in 1978. And I said at the beginning of the show, there's two films that I think have changed the course of horror films. And Halloween was definitely one of them. It made the slasher film what it is today, even though I think Black Christmas kind of shaped that in a way, too, in odd sort of ways. But Halloween definitely made it popular. I think Dawn of the Dead, for a lot of different reasons, reshaped the way that horror films were made because it turned the zombie splatter craze on. It introduced everybody effectively to Tom Savini, who was then introduced to everybody in Friday the 13th, which then led to all those films in the 80s that used the splatter stuff that Tom Savini did. So there's just a whole lot of shit in this movie that was really, really influential.
The thing I think, though, Dawn of the Dead is, the type of movie I think it is completely different than a movie like Halloween. Like, Halloween is meant to scare the shit out of you, like the way it's made. Dawn of the Dead is more like a roller coaster, like it's an amusement park ride that's a horror movie. I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff in it as well. I don't really think it was meant to be scary, but maybe, I don't know, maybe it was. I never did see it as scary. I saw it as one of those movies that was just a lot of fun. It was an adventure film, sort of exploitation movie as well. There's a lot of gore in it, a lot of really cool music in it. Goblin did some of the music in it. Yeah, I always liked Dawn of the Dead quite a bit. I mean, I'm definitely not a huge mark for it like you are, but I mean, it's a fun movie. I always thought, another thing we should mention on here too, I always thought the theatrical edition of Dawn of the Dead was by far the best edition of the movie, and I know a lot of people don't agree with that, but fuck, I always thought it was the best version of the film.
Mm-hmm. I think that, I agree with that. I think that Dawn of the Dead is one of those movies to me where everything in that movie worked for me, and it captured a certain feeling. Like, I really did think, from the first time I ever saw that movie when I was a kid to even, like, when I watch it now for, like, the 100th time or whatever, that if shit like that happened, that that was probably what would happen. Like, he captured that a feeling as far as, like, all the emergency broadcasting stuff that's throughout the film where it gives you that feeling, like, that kind of started in Night of Living Dead the way they did that, that you're there and that that would be what would be happening if you were there. Like, you would have people would just be fucking freaking out and, like, going in different directions trying to get away or trying to find some place to, like, hole up. You add that kind of atmosphere with the gore that Savini put in it, and you're right, it is like a fun movie. It's like an adventure movie. I never thought of it as a horror film as much as I did, like, an adventure film. You got bikers in it. You got, you know, the shootout scenes in it from, you know, the apartment complex. There's a lot more going on there.
Pie fights.
Yeah, pie fights and shit in the middle of it. There's a
which
lot.
I still don't get that, but, you know.
I don't either, but that part worked too.
It's just, yeah, it's a fun movie. It's kind of odd. It's kind of like a cartoon too. Like a lot of the movie, especially with the fake blood in it. And just the way it was shot, like, it was almost, it's almost like a cartoon come to life in a lot of ways, in a lot of scenes in the movie and stuff. And you have bikers in it. It's really like a lot of people would say it's the ultimate drive-in movie because it has almost everything. Like, it does have.
It exploits the shit out of a lot of different genres, I'll say that.
It doesn't have a whole lot of nudity in it, I'll say that. I think you briefly get to see, Alexis Dubin's titties.
Yeah, which you also get to see in the hot tub scene of Mad Men, which is great.
I love that song, too.
Yeah.
So, what else can we say about Dawn of the Dead? The Ultimate Edition is out on DVD. It's probably one of the best box sets that the horror world has ever seen. I would say
it's another film, too, where nobody in that film was known before that movie. Just like Halloween. I mean, nobody in Halloween except for Donald Pleasance had any fucking...
I don't know. I remember David Emge's role in The Booby Hatch.
Do you?
Yeah.
That was a good one. They basically took... It was one of the only films I can think of where they took, like, all unknown people, put them in there, and they actually gave credible, likable performances. Like, I thought Scott Reiniger, that was, like, one of my favorite characters of all time, and Ken Foray as well. I mean, he did a great job, and I don't think he ever even came close to pulling off a role as good as that again.
What about Big Joe Grizzly?
Oh, God.
I'm shitting in here. Motherfucker, I'll fuck you up in the fucking head.
I'm dropping some tears now.
You better come back later. I'm dropping shit. I'll fuck your world up.
You ain't gonna be stealing my coveralls, Michael Myers. Fuck you. I'm dropping this load in here.
Yeah, because Rob Zombie felt the need to explain where he got the fucking coveralls that he wears in there. That was his biggest problem with Halloween, yeah.
Yeah. And how the hell did Michael Myers learn to drive?
I don't
God.
Know.
God. That aggravated the fuck
you
out
know,
of me.
You know what? Going back, not to get off on another tangent, I was watching Halloween again recently, too. There's a part in it where somebody says, how the hell did he learn to drive? And Donald Pleasant says, well, I don't know, somebody here probably gave him lessons. It's like, what the fuck more explanation do you need? It's mentioned in the film itself. How did he learn it? Well, somebody probably taught him there.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of dumbasses that work there at Pine Grove.
I don't understand that. Like, that's the biggest, like, logical fallacy. Never mind the fact that at the end of Halloween he gets shot in the fucking head and now he's back. That's fine.
Oh, my God, I'm chasing my brother in
it. And by the way, we're never going to quit talking about these movies. Like, because we hate these movies, and we have a right to talk about them, so fuck you.
Yeah. What would you do? Well, no, wait, they did my remake Dawn of the Dead, I forgot!
If they remade Dawn of the Dead, oh, no, I'd shit myself.
That's pretty bad if you forget they remake something. Yeah, the Dawn of the Dead remake wasn't too bad.
I was really pleasantly surprised by that, because out of all the remakes, Dawn of the Dead is probably, like, the best one.
It's up there. I mean, I think the Last House on the Left remake is really good, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But Dawn of the Dead, I mean, it's an all-time classic. It's like one of those movies that you ain't going to go to a horror convention anywhere and not see something Dawn of the Dead related or see some zombies from the movie.
Nope.
Sign autograph stuff.
That's another thing, too. There were so many damn people in that movie. Like, so many zombies, it was, like, overwhelming when you go back and look at it now. They had so many extras in that fucking movie, and so many of them went on to, like, do conventions and stuff. It's fucking astounding. The bikers and shit do conventions.
Yeah. It's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, but it was, I mean, in the context of it being an awesome film.
Like, Fright Night Film Fest, there was some other guy, I think it was G. Joe Shelby or something like that, mm-hmm. that actually just showed up with Mike Christopher, and he wasn't even on the guest list. He just kind of showed up. He bought a ticket and sat behind his table.
I tell you what, though. The cool thing about that movie, too, it kind of reminds me of Star Wars in the end of the fact where it had so many memorable characters in it that people still, like, pick out to this day. Like, even the zombies became kind of infamous. They became, like, cult icons. You had the nurse zombie and the sweater zombie and the screwdriver zombie, and then you had all the different bikers, the Tommy gun biker and the, you know, the heavy biker and
It looks like one man gang.
Exactly. All those things became like kind of iconic. The Hare Krishna zombie and all that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, classic movie. Classic year. I mean, think all the stuff that came out that year, and looking back at some stuff we talked about, it's sort of insane.
Yeah, so 1978 was definitely a year that shaped horror films as we know it today, even.
Yeah. So, with that, that is it. That's 1978, our year in review, Uncle Bill. Groovy,
it sure
bitches,
was.
Groovy.
It was a lot of fun.
So, with that, we're going to take a break, and we will get back. We're going to take your phone calls, read your fan mail. I think we're going to have Jeff from Scarefest on here in a second.
Jeffrey.
That'll be fun. So we will be back after this break here on DeadBeard.com.
From the creator of Halloween and the star of The Exorcist, Linda Blair in Hell Night. Garth Manor. Where the unseen, the unspeakable, hides its terror in cobwebbed corridors. Linda Blair, Vincent Van Patten, and Peter Barton in Hell Night. From Compass International, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Dead Pit Radio. I'm the Creepy Kentuckian.
I am Uncle Bill.
We've got DJ Jazzy Jeff Waldridge on here from the Scarefest, the promoter behind the Scarefest show in Lexington coming up here in a couple weeks. And we're going to talk a little bit about the show, because last year's show was a huge surprise to me. We were talking about earlier because we didn't really know what to expect. There'd never been a horror convention in Lexington before, and it ended up being a really successful show. So, of course, you're doing it again this year.
Yeah, we're doing it again this year, and the thing is, it's double the size of last year, so it's grown a whole lot since last year, and it's really blown up. We're having a lot more people come out and film for television shows and pilots and I mean, it's kind of turning into a big event for this side of the country.
Yeah, you've got a ton of people scheduled to be there as well. And a lot of these choices we were talking about, really, really great choices as far as people that are instantly recognizable. I know you got Doug Bradley's going to be there. Everybody knows who that is. Talk a little bit more about those, some of the main guests that you got coming.
We've got Doug Bradley, which played Pinhead, of course. We've got Gunnar Hansen, Kane Hodder's coming back, B. Wallace, Daniel Harris, Leslie Easterbrook, Ken Free's going to be there, Priscilla Barnes, Robert Kurtzman's going to be there. He don't do many events.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Let's see. We've got Caroline Williams will be there, James Hampton, Lou Temple, Brian Libby. For the paranormal people, the headliners are Travel Channel's Ghost Adventures and Chip Coffee and Bill Burns from the UFO Hunter Show. So we've got a huge lineup planned so far.
Another one that I thought was really interesting, I don't know if you mentioned before, was Jack Ketchum.
He was kind of a late addition. It was kind of weird how that happened. But he contacted us, and I guess we had kind of talked to him, you know, at the end of last year. But nothing was set in stone, and he contacted me via email and said, I think I'm supposed to be at your show. And he said, my webmaster has it listed on my webpage. And he said, I never look at my dates on my webpage, but I did this time. And I wanted to contact you and see. And I said, we had never heard anything, but I said, sure. I said, we can work something out. So it was kind of weird how it just kind of fell in our lap.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of odd how we've had things like that happen with last year and this year, just things falling in our lap and kind of coming, you know, coming to happen. It's kind of like fate or something. It's odd.
But I think a lot of these people that do these shows, too, you know, word of mouth gets around about a show being, you know, I'm sure a lot of the people that were there last year were telling their friends and other people they attend these shows with how successful it was. And, you know, pretty much everybody just wants to come to the show. You know, a lot of people contact you, I'm guessing, now more than you contacting people, right?
Yeah, it's insane the people that contact me. You never know who's going to call. Like, you know, one day I was asleep and Danielle Harris called me on the phone. And, you know, she wanted to be a guest, so we talked and we worked it out. And, you know, it's weird because you never know who's going to be on the other side of the phone and you never know who's going to email you. Because word gets around and these people pass your number and email on to other people. And then they just contact you out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah, well, I was going to say, I wish Danielle Harris would call me when I was halfway asleep. I'd probably shit on myself, though.
See, that's the thing. She called, and she was like, I was like, hello. And she said, this is Danielle Harris. She said, you might, you know who I am from these films. And I was sitting there thinking, of course I know who you are. But,
yeah.
You know, go ahead and I'll let you get through it. I said, how odd is that? You know, not everybody gets a phone call from Danielle Harris every day.
Yeah, yeah. I might know her from my entire childhood.
Yeah,
I remember.
I might know her from every movie that I've seen with you in it, but sure, go ahead and explain who you are.
But I don't know why, but I'm really, really excited about Brian Libby and Robert Kurtzman. I think I'm excited about Brian Libby because of Silent Rage, and I'm excited about Robert Kurtzman because of just the immense amount of work that he's done and the fact that he's been a real good friend of the show and stuff as well.
The craziest thing is I'm not even excited about the big guest. I mean, I want to see them. That's cool. That's fine, meeting them and all that kind of stuff, getting stuff signed. I'm excited about James Hampton from Teen Wolf. I'm excited about Brian Libby from Silent Rage. And I'm excited about Robert Kurtzman because, you know, Brian Libby and James Hampton, they're in two of my favorite movies of all time, and Silent Rage and Teen Wolf. And, I mean, I told everybody, I said, those two people are kind of like a gift to me.
Yeah.
I said, you know, everybody else likes these other guests, but I said, you know, those two guys are two people I really want to, you know, meet and get things signed from. So, I mean, it's interesting to kind of know, you know, perspectives on things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I can tell you one particular person I'm looking forward to seeing again. I just saw her a couple of weeks ago, Tucky Williams.
Oh, Lord, Tucky.
Oh, baby. I want to get Tucky-fied.
You're going to get lucky with Tucky.
Oh,
Lord. Actually, yeah. You're not going to get lucky with Tucky. But
I was telling
Tucky's awesome. You know, the commercial that she was in for the Scarefest, that's one of the most popular ones with the blood donation thing. So
yeah, I can see how that would be the most popular one.
Yeah, it's, people are really interested in that. You always watch their eyes, and they look at the cleavage before, you know, you watch people's eyes when they're watching the commercial and know what they're focused on.
Indeed. She's a big girl, too. I mean, as far as height,
she's
like
about 6
yeah.
foot.
Yeah.
When she put on those platform shoes for the commercial, God, she was like 8 foot tall. I mean, it was insane. We had to like set her down that way she wouldn't be taller than Jason was in the commercial. So it was crazy. I said, "Yeah, we're gonna have to set her down."
Yeah, for sure. Somebody else I definitely want to ask about. Maybe you know the status on the Doodle family if they're going to be
the coming. Doodle family. That's that's one of my favorite things from last year. Oh my God, I cracked up because I didn't know if I was the only one that noticed it, and I knew you guys were like right there, and the woman was just running around going, "Come over here, Doodle, get over here." I love that family, and they were really upset because they didn't get to meet Sid Haig. So I actually kind of went up to him and I said, "I'll tell you what, if you want to come back tomorrow, if you want to do whatever," I said, "I'll let you in where you can meet him tomorrow," because his flight got delayed. But, I don't know the status on the Doodle family, but I'd say, who knows, they may come back.
The thing I always remember, though, is they were getting their picture with Kane Hodder. I don't know if you saw this.
I don't think I did, but I've heard you guys talk about it.
Then the little baby Doodle, of course, which we always mention Doodle, we thinking of the grandmother is usually what we're talking about. But Doodle is actually the little baby. And the little baby was like asleep or something, and they wanted to get the picture of the little baby Doodle with Kane Hodder. And as Kane Hodder was picking up the baby, it was like just falling over on him, So it almost looked like it was trying to breastfeed from Kane Hodder.
And I'll tell you what, I've got so many stories from last year's convention. I'll share a couple of them with you that many people don't know. And one of them is for the special Friday the 13th showing at the Kentucky Theater. Everybody, we had this, band to take everybody down there, all the stars and everything, where they could do the Paramount shoot. Well, the thing is, the band took off, and it left me, Harry Manfredini, and Ari Lehman there at the hotel. Well, I said, there's no way in hell I can walk anymore. So there was these carriages outside, the carriage rides. So I went outside and I asked the lady, I said, how much? And she said, I'll do this for you. So it was me, Harry Manfredini, my girlfriend, Ari Lehman, and we took that carriage ride to the Kentucky Theater, one of those white carriage rides that you see around downtown Lexington.
Right.
And we had a romantic carriage ride to the Kentucky Theater because I didn't want to walk anymore.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I saw Ari at Fright Night, and he was like, man, that was so cool with the carriage ride. I said, you realize that we were the only one that did that, right? And he said, no, I didn't know that. He said, I thought you did that with everybody. I said, no. I said, I just didn't want to walk anymore. I said, yeah. The other guy's got a van. So, that's one of the interesting stories that
we got.
A
special intimate moment for just you and Ari Lehman.
I said, how crazy is that that we rode in that carriage ride all the way to the Kentucky Theater? And there's just stories like that. That's what people don't see. It's the behind the scenes stuff for these events. And you really get to know these people. And one of the coolest things, and I wish everybody could have been there for it, but on that Thursday night of last year's convention, that's when everybody got into town, and it truly was a Friday the 13th reunion. Because they hadn't seen Victor Miller since he had done the movie. Since he had wrote the movie. And some of these guys had not seen each other in a while. And, it was cool to sit in the lobby of the hotel and just sit and listen to these guys talk. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. The behind-the-scenes stories are what's fun. That's the fun stuff.
Cool. Now, I know that you've got a couple more movies planned for the Kentucky Theater, and we were at the Friday the 13th screening last year, and that was really, really cool to see that. And I know you have a couple more movies planned for this year. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. When I booked the movies for the Kentucky Theater, me and the film booker kind of goes through it, and he sees what's available. And you got to send them a list because some of these prints aren't out there. And I try to do it with what would people want to see like they were watching it for the first time. And so that's where we got the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Because how cool is that to watch a print of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre like you're seeing it for the very first time?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I tried for Hellraiser. I tried for Cujo. You know, I tried for several films. And I said, well, let's try for Friday the 13th, part 7. So that was kind of, one of the options we had. So that one came through. And, those are two films that would be really cool to watch in the theater with everybody.
Yeah, I think that Friday the 13th screening that was last year was probably one of the most memorable experiences I've ever had, especially if the people from the film actually do show up and do the introductions or show up and watch the film or whatever. That's always
right.
Cool.
And it's kind of interesting because Victor Miller, he introduced the film and then he left. He didn't stay for the whole movie. But, some of them did. Some of them sat down and watched it. And, it's interesting because it may be the first time they've seen the film on a big screen like that since the premiere.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting to see. I not only try to make memorable moments for the fans, but also for the stars. And, if you do that, it seems like they always want to come back. And I don't know. I just try to build memories, I guess, if you want to get sappy about it. but really, the Kentucky Theater is a cool place to watch those movies because it's really like one of the old theaters that would have shown those movies first run.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You can kind of go back in time a little bit.
Well, it's a huge theater, too. I mean, the main theater, I think there's two separate ones in the Kentucky, but the main one is huge.
So. Yeah, the main theater can hold about 1,500 people is what they were telling me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's huge. And there's been, the history of the place is crazy. Because, they showed, the original Dracula and stuff there. And they've got all these pictures in the lobby of the huge lobby cards for Dracula and everything. So, it's the history. It's really neat to see the history behind the place. And the Midnight movies have been going there ever since, 70s or 80s, I think. So.
Right. Well, I think later on, throughout October, they're going to have the Goonies playing, so I'm going to definitely go back and try to watch one of those. I know we have a few weekends where we're going to be there for football games, so I'll check one of those out as well. They're always doing cool stuff there at the Kentucky Theater.
Yeah, and one thing that I like about it is you can see a lot of rare films when they first come out. Like they showed Let the Right One In on the big screen there before it got released on DVD. So, they always show movies that people want to see. That's the interesting part about, that theater.
Cool. So, any other activities and stuff you have planned for Scarefest
that
you want to...
You know there's got to be some Q&As and stuff going on as well.
Q&As going on, yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah, we've got, right now, one Q&A that we're going to do is a man behind the monster thing, and we're going to do people that's, worn makeup, have been in this heavy makeup for these roles where they can kind of discuss what they went through. Doug Bradley and Kane Hodder and Walter Flynn and, just different people like that that's actually had to wear this heavy makeup to do these roles. Then we're also looking at it's either going to be a Halloween Q&A or, a Rob Zombie film Q&A or to be maybe the Ladies of Horror Q&A. One of those. I'm still working with the idea a little bit, but it's announced, it's scheduled. I just kind of got to work out the details on the seminar. Also, Kurtzman is going to be doing a seminar, too, Q&A. He's going to be showing the trailer for his new film, which looks really good. Something about some kind of crazy snake lady or something. So, it's some kind of weird legend in another country. I don't know, but the lady's basically in full makeup all over the body, and she looks like a snake, so it looks pretty cool. It's called Hiss or something of that nature.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't heard much about that, so we'll definitely have to check that out, too. But I'm sure you're already thinking ahead, to next year's show. Any ideas on what you might be wanting to do for that show as well?
The thing about next year's show, and this is what's driving me nuts, those damn horse games are in Lexington at the same time we are. And that's great. God bless the world equestrian games. But they're playing hell with Scarefest. We're trying to pin our dates down. It'll be around the same time that we do it every year. But I'm already working on guests. Already working on a theme. So it should be pretty huge if what comes through actually comes through like I want it to.
Crazy Fat Ethel reunion.
Yep, that's what it's going to be.
I knew it.
You're going to dig up the lady play Crazy Fat Ethel.
Yeah.
Ever there.
Oh, but yeah, the and another cool thing this year that we're doing is we're actually going to get to show the full-length film Colin, which is a huge zombie film. It took the Cannes Film Festival. People were going nuts over it. And it cost $70. That was the amount of money that was spent on the film. And
wow.
It's shot from the perspective of the zombie. And it looks really good from the trailers and previews I've seen. And we'll see what people think about it. But it's really going to be the first time in America that it's going to be shown. But, you know, we can't, you know, announce it as the North American premiere because of film festivals.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All those major distribution rights. But we were going to, you know, first off do a preview with it, with the director introduction. But what come about is he didn't have time, so he said, I'll send you the whole movie and you can show it all. So that kind of worked out really good for us.
Very cool, yeah. So is there anything else you want to mention that we haven't talked about on here or just want to...
Basically, we've got, you know, the pub crawl. That's the first time we're doing that, where you can pay $5 and you get discounts to all these local bars that are within walking distance.
So I'm sure that'll get a lot of use.
You know, we will.
Yeah, everybody can get drunk and, you know, parade the streets. But really just, you know, it's going to be huge. The booths are sold out right now. We've got approximately, I would say, 150 vendors.
So wow.
We've got basically anything you would want to get, you know, you can get it there. And, you know, a lot of the booths that were there last year, they'll be back this year. So if you've seen something last year, you know, you can pretty much get it this year. So
cool.
I think people will be a little more kind of, I don't know, trained, I guess you could say, because last year a lot of people had never been to a horror convention at King.
Yeah, I know.
And they didn't know what to expect with autograph prices and stuff. So.
Yeah, there was a lot of people that actually came from our area that we knew and stuff, people we went to school with and shit that, you know, I had no idea they were into that sort of thing anyway. So, yeah, a lot of people, it was a first-time show. And I think that was a lot of your audience, really. I mean, was a lot of the local people in East, you know, people in Eastern Kentucky. And I just think Kentucky is a good area for a show because a lot of people can get to the state, a lot of surrounding areas and stuff like that.
Yeah, we're, you know, and the thing is about Lexington and Louisville is we're really close, and people can drive there one day and go back home. So, I mean, you know, they don't have to stay all night. And I think that's why Lexington and Louisville does so well with stuff like this.
Cool.
And, you know, last year I think it was a lot of local audience. And we had people come from other countries, you know, like Canada and things. And we got people coming this year from Canada. But a lot of it is our local crowd. And it is the Eastern Kentucky crowd, Virginia, and things like that. Because they can't travel to some of these shows in New Jersey and things.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the time and money, so if it's close, they can come.
Yeah.
Well, we were telling people, I mean, if you want to make a lot of money, you got to go to the Scarefest as far as vendors and stuff like that go. Because, I mean, if last year was a huge success. I don't know if you have the numbers on that, but that's one of the most fucking crowded conventions that I've ever been to.
One of the numbers that we have, after counting the comp tickets that the radio stations and everything, I think was around 4,799, somewhere around there. But it was around 5,000.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sounds about
so,
right.
I mean, that was the figures we got after counting all the comp tickets.
And you know, that's usually unheard of, too, of a show outside of the Northeast drawing that many people. I mean, aside from maybe San Diego Comic-Con or something like that, you know.
Yeah, and the thing is, that's the stars were like, you know, they were blown away because they said this was the most successful first-year convention that we've ever been to. And they said it's ridiculous because your show runs like a 4 or 5 year show.
Right.
And, you know, Kane Hodder asked, he said, how long have you been running this? I said, this is the first year. He said, well, it runs like it's 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I've worked hard on trying to get the kinks out. And one thing that did that was, you know, we didn't let problems be known to everybody. I mean, you know, we have, you know, radio ear pieces. That way, if there's a problem, we only hear it. And we can take care of it. And it keeps the morale of the crowd up because if there's a problem, we try to take care of it. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all about making people happy. That's what we try to do.
Cool. Well, hopefully the second year will be even bigger. And we appreciate you joining us. And it's the Scarefest at Lexington Center, September 11th through the 13th. So everybody.
And another thing, on the 11th, we've got the September 11th promotion. We're going to let all fire, EMS, police, and active military, as long as they show an ID at the box office, they will get in free on September 11th only. So
cool.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Well, man, we appreciate you joining us. And best of luck with the show. I guess we'll see you there.
Yep, see you there.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You take care.
We'll see you, Jeff.
All right, see you.
All right, bye. So, yeah, that was an interesting call in. Uncle Bill's, is your mic working?
Yeah, I think it's all right now.
So we can get in to taking some phone calls. Hello, you're on Dead Pit Radio with the Creepy Kentuckian and Uncle Bill. Who's this?
This is Schlogs.
Hello, Schlogs.
Oh, Lord. Give it to us. What's going on?
Lay it down!
I don't know. I was just calling about 1978.
Oh, I was scared there's going to be something heavy coming. I don't know.
Well, I know we're not allowed to talk about He Who Shall Not Be Named.
Right.
So, yeah, I had a movie from, are people actually calling in about that, or?
Well, you're actually the first caller. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a brief interview up until now with the Scarefest promoter. So you're a first caller.
Oh, sweet. Well, yeah, I was just calling to talk about, I know that Halloween and, of course, Dawn of the Dead are the classics that everybody refers to, but one that I watched recently, again, that I thought was one of the probably better films of 78 was The Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake. Did you guys see that one?
We mentioned that one.
Yeah,
but that was one of those deals where we haven't, you know, watched it recently, at least in the last 10, 15 years. So we didn't really talk about it.
Oh, really?
It too much. Yeah.
Okay. Cause they put out that, that crappy remake with Nicole Kidman.
Oh, just The Invasion. Yeah.
Yeah, and that one was in 2008, and they figured, well, 30th anniversary, so they put out this two-disc thing trying to capitalize on that, and I picked that up from a pawn shop and watched it and all the special features, and that movie is totally brilliant. I mean, it's one of those rare horror movies that has a huge budget behind it, well, for horror,
mm-hmm.
and it had just, like, so many... The guy that directed that, Philip Kaufman, actually went on to direct The Right Stuff, which is a, you know... Oscar-winning film in its own right, but it's just there's so much talent in front of the camera and behind it, and it's really rare that you see a studio put a lot of money into a movie like that, especially one like that that it's got like a ton of gore in it, which is it's really like I think it kick-started the whole 80s splatter trend. I mean, it's really really sloppy.
Yeah, I've got that one on DVD, but it's one of those deals where, you know, when we review stuff for the show, we don't really have a lot of time to watch a lot of these other stuff, but like, yeah, I'll definitely have to check that one out.
Now, am I crazy, or wasn't there another Invasion of the Body Snatchers that was by like Abel Ferreira or something too?
Well, yeah, he did one. I don't remember what year that was. I think that was actually like 89 or 90 or something. But then there was also one in, I think 94 called The Puppet Masters, I think it was called, that had a, Donald Sutherland was also in that one, and that was actually a really well done movie too. So, but yeah, they've made that story like 35 times, and
yeah.
I gotta say that from what I've seen, that is definitely the best one. Like, got Donald Sutherland and just a ton of people in it. Jeff Goldblum, Leonard Nimoy. It's a really,
it's
really
got Jeff Goldblum, and I can't watch it.
Shit.
What do you have against Goldblum?
He's just one of those guys that just irritates me. Like, I just don't like him.
Sam Neill.
Well, he's not as bad as Sam Neill. Well, maybe he is.
I'll tell you, Bill Pullman's one of those guys for me. He irritates the shit out of me.
Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's guys like that for everybody. You just don't like watching them in movies. I mean, you can't really explain it. He's just annoying to me. Like, pretty much everything he's in, I can't stand.
Oh. Well, it's a pretty brief role, but I think for me, an actor like that is, do you guys know the actor Wings Hauser?
Yeah, that's one of the,
I don't know
every
that
time
one.
I see that guy, I just, I just lose it. I hate that dude, and I have no idea why. So I totally understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few people like that. Sam Neill, of course, everyone knows that one, too. But who were you saying, Uncle Bill?
Oh, I was saying Bill Pullman. I can't stand him. And, like, for a brief period of time in the 90s, people, like, after Independence Day, people were putting him in all kinds of shit, and it was just horrible.
I believe you once referred to him as he of the blank stare and the expressionless acting.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, yeah.
Yeah, he's never, you know, never registers whatsoever. He's like in a movie, and they might as well just have some sort of a robot or a mannequin that was animated.
Yeah, it's like Liv. It's kind of like Liv Tyler. She's one.
Oh.
Where she just kind of shows up.
I sort of liked her in Silent Fall, though. That was pretty good.
Yeah. She could look scared and upset throughout that whole film.
Silent Fall was the one that she did with Richard Dreyfuss, and she had the brother that was autistic. I think Linda Hamilton was in that, too.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
Huh, I see. Well, what were some of the other than those three?
Man, there was a ton of them. There was a ton of them that we got into that a lot of people probably don't realize came out in 78. I Spit on Your Grave is one of them. Magic. Okay.
The Devil Dog, Hound from Hell. It was,
yeah, that one. Piranha.
Piranha, I barely remember that movie.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of stuff that came out that year, surprisingly.
Yeah, I was looking through my DVD rack, just trying to think of something and see what else there was, but then I remembered that one came out. And yeah, you guys should really check that out. It's one of those great movies that actually, not to, you know, spoiler alert, but I mean, it has the balls to actually end the world. Most movies don't. They kind of go there and step back from the brink of madness and find some way to resolve the issue. But I have a soft spot for movies that just, okay, that's the end. That's really terrifying, especially that movie is very famous for the iconic ending with Donald Sutherland pointing and screaming. And I was watching all the special features on it, and the guy that designed the sound effects for the screams that the aliens did and all the other stuff was actually Ben Burtt, who did the sound design for like Star Wars, and he just did WALL-E last year. So there's like tons of Hollywood heavyweights were involved in that movie. And yeah, it's one of those great instances where all the makeup, of course, is prosthetics, and there's just a surprising amount of gore. So yeah, you guys should check that out.
Yeah. You're making me actually want to go back and watch that now. I haven't seen it in so long. I just had no idea.
Well, it's really interesting when they're talking about it in the features, they're saying how it's a really dark movie, but because the people making it were so good at their job, it's actually dark for a purpose. It's because it like forces you to kind of focus harder and look more into it. And it really does serve to draw you in and make you like really on the edge of your seat the whole time, because yeah, it's just excellent craftsmanship. And I was totally shocked when I watched that again. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like we're going to have to, you've actually motivated me. I'm going to actually check it out now. I've had it for like, I've had the DVD for probably about 5 years and never opened it. So,
well, yeah, give it a spin. You won't be disappointed. I guarantee it.
Cool. Well, man, we appreciate you calling, and I'm sure we'll talk at you again soon.
All right, I appreciate it. You bear Jews have a good night there.
You take care, Schlogsy.
All right, we'll see you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
You gonna have to hold on a second.
Ain't no bad Jew, goddammit.
Let's get started with these fan questions here, Uncle Bill. There's actually quite a few of them.
Let's do this shit.
Ben, our good buddy Ben, says, do you guys feel weird when you see people like John Landis, PJ Souls, Tiffany Shepis, Lloyd Kaufman, Kane Hodder, etc. listed on IMDb with a credit for your movie? It's got to be a bit surreal.
It is, really, when you consider, like, what kind of parts a lot of those people have in the movie.
Yeah, they're barely in it, to be honest.
Like John Landis.
PJ Souls is like in it, barely at the end.
Yeah.
At least John Landis is in a scene with me or whatever, I guess.
Yeah, she's in a scene just for the sole purpose of making fun of us.
Yeah. Oh, they look weird. Them people are fucking weird. They're hillbillies.
Although some people like Tiffany Shepis are really in the film, like for an extended period of time.
Yeah, and she's seen interacting with us.
Yeah, so. She is. She's cool.
That sort of makes sense. What else you got, Uncle Bill?
Hmm. Well, this Zoomga guy writes in and says, to answer the guy from the last show, Flyboy took Roger and Peter in the chopper up to the trucks on the hill, talking about Dawn of the Dead. And he says, after they drove the trucks down to the mall to block the doors, at that point, I guess Steven was just there in case of emergencies. So there you go, buddy. There's the answer to that question. What was Flyboy doing just flying around in the helicopter for no apparent reason?
Flyboy's playing with himself.
Anyway, back to a question, though, from SFX. He says, I was wondering, CK and Uncle Bill, when the work print version of End of the Pit is sold out and sells for millions on eBay, will you be selling a bootleg version on the website before an official release or releasing it as a special extreme extended uncut version DVD? I've heard that it was an hour and 50 minutes long and is going to be cut down to 90 minutes. So this is just a fan wanting to know about the documentary.
I don't think we can sell that work print without getting sued.
We can ask the suit on.
Like, if we weren't going to receive any legal action, we'd probably, you know, we'd sell it.
Yeah, but pretty much, though.
We can't.
I'm guessing that it's been decided that there's not going to be any other editions of that DVD come out until the official release.
Yeah, so we got another phone call here.
Hello, you're on Deadbeat Radio. Who's this?
This is Ike.
Wow, what the hell's going on, Ike?
Wow, I'm surprised I actually got through. I figured you guys would be close to not taking calls.
Well, the thing is, we did have a interview, sort of, you know, one of those deals where it was a live interview, as live as it can get with us, with a convention promoter talking about the Scarefest, and that took up quite a bit of time. So we were sort of late getting started on the call-ins, a little bit, what, probably about 8:15, 8:20 when we finally started taking phone calls.
Okay, well, that worked out well, at least for me, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys,
so,
honestly.
So what's going on, brother?
Oh, well, nothing at all, man. I actually caught the Into the Pit screener. I got it in the mail yesterday, and I viewed it.
Okay.
And really, really good.
Cool. I'm
really
glad,
good.
Glad you liked it. I think, considering what Kelly had to work with, you know, and he only came down here twice, I think it turned out as good as anybody like me and Uncle Bill could have ever expected, you know.
Yeah. It was, I thought it was good. What's your feedback about it, though, as far as good points, bad points?
Geez. Well, I mean, I talked to Kelly about it. I called him because we've been mixing things up together. We've been getting some projects off the ground, moving and shaking, you know, mm-hmm. how it goes. And I talked to him about it, and he pretty much went through it, like, well, not beat for beat, but he went through most of it with me when I was asking him questions and moving and shaking, obviously. And I agree with the length. Probably, an hour and 50 minutes is, like, when I first watched it, I was like, what are people talking about? That's crazy. This movie is, you know, this is really good. I can't think of a way to improve it. And then I watched it with my girlfriend, and then I came over to my parents' house because I'm doing some stuff I've worked over here for them, and I showed it to them, and the second viewing is like, yeah, it is pretty long at some point.
Yeah,
I mean I still enjoyed it. I didn't get up once, which is rare for me within the span of an hour and 50 minutes,
right.
And during a second viewing within the span of just a few hours. Like a double feature of the same movie. It's insane. I really don't know if I could give Kelly any constructive points on it. One thing, I'm going to get through the stammering and say, I don't know if I felt that there was really an uneven balance between the UB and the CK. It wasn't as glaring to me as maybe it was to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I thought it was, I mean, I thought the narrative was pretty well balanced. I didn't think it was like,
so you think
I didn't think it was the Uncle Bill show with CK doing wacky stuff in the background or anything. I mean, I thought it pretty evenly. I mean, maybe it could have done a few more things. And I think when I listened to last week's show today, and yeah, I mean, there probably could have been more stuff about, I guess, the basic construction of the show, but
well, from what I understand from talking with Kelly, when he does re-edit it, that's all going to be evened out as well too. Also, though, just a lot of people have been complaining about the lack of stuff with Fangoria and that kind of stuff in it. that really had nothing to do with us as far as, I mean, we did record a lot of stuff about Fangoria. It's just that they didn't really help us out any and try like,
of course, yeah, yeah,
and try to, or not even help us out, but like give their own side of the story in any way that could be used in the documentary. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know. Considering what he has to work with, and if you know anything about like the nature of making a documentary, it's pretty much taking whatever you have and doing what you can with it. I think maybe with other audiences who don't know about the whole Fangoria, conflict thing, that might go over a little easier.
Well,
and plus, I mean, is the Fangoria thing even really that prevalent anymore?
We don't ever really talk about Fangoria anymore.
But I think that when we started the show, I mean, there were two big aspects that really had us standing out from these other sides is, you know, we were calling out Fangoria, which is something you just don't do. We've learned, you know, and the Eli Roth thing, which I'm sort of glad that that wasn't included now, especially after I saw the finished documentary, because it's a documentary first. I mean, I think it's a movie for everybody. I mean, you don't even have to be a fan of the show or anything. And I think that was a really smart move for Kelly to make it a movie anybody can really watch and enjoy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I showed it to my family, which includes my folks and my brother. And they got into it, I mean, at least. Well, my parents, let me give you a little backstory here. My parents are older people, obviously, and they don't watch movies as normal people do. They'll like watch the first 30 minutes of a movie, no matter what it is. It could be like The Godfather or whatever, and then they'll get up and they'll talk to their dogs, or they'll go get more food, or they'll do something else, and they'll come back like 15 or 20 minutes later.
Right.
So, that's not really a normal audience, but my brother watched it, and I think I told him about the show a few times, but he's not really a hardcore horror fan. He's kind of a casual horror guy, and I think he really liked it. He got really giddy during the scenes of the John Carpenter interview.
Mm-hmm.
He's a huge John Carpenter mark, and he's like, "Oh my God, I interviewed John Carpenter," and that was literally what he said. And he said it in that really stupid voice of his. I just imitated over the phone. So sure, he'll appreciate that. But yeah, I mean, I think if he whittles it down to 90 minutes or, 100 minutes, I'm sure it'll be. It could be like a really big hit. I mean, I think it'll make waves within the horror community anyway. From what I understand, people are already, talking about it outside of the Dead Pit circle.
I had no idea if they are. We're kind of in a bubble as far as what information we have about
it. We're hoping that the West Coast elite picks up on it. You know, the horror journalists out in L.A. that do it for a living. I mean, that would be great.
Yeah, horror journalists out in L.A. I don't know.
Yeah, just don't even go there. Don't even worry about it.
Well, I don't think it's worth it. That's so many cheap little pot shots.
Do really have like a really strong desire to have that screened in like by somebody at Rue Morgue, though. I don't know why, but I think that Rue Morgue magazine and stuff like that would probably get that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what Kelly's going to do is he's going to wait to get the.
Well, I know that. I'm just saying that's my hope.
From what I understand, I mean, as you guys probably know, I have minor connections within the Rue Morgue establishment. It's really a Rue Morgue family. Because
mm-hmm.
They're all related. I don't know if you guys knew that or not. All of them.
It's like Salyersville, Kentucky.
It is. Yeah. It's exactly like it. And they don't like outsiders either. And they don't like outsiders coming in and trying to fuck with their shit.
Right.
So don't even try to do that. Don't be like, hey, guys, you should be less Canadian. Because they'll just get fucking pissed at you.
What I'm thinking we could do, though, is when we send the screener copy, actually send them a box of Kraft dinner with it.
To woo them.
Try to bribe them a little bit, you know.
I think that'll go over.
Yeah, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, I mentioned, because I've written more than a few things on the whole movie piece, which is one reason I was so keyed up about seeing it. But yeah, apparently they know of it. I know that much.
I think Stuart Andrews listens to the show quite a bit, so he should know about it. And we call him, I'm the creepy Kentuckian, he's the Scottish Canadian, mm-hmm. is what we call him. So maybe we can pass it along to him, and he can pass it along to Jovanka, I think is how you pronounce her name.
Yeah, I think it is Jovanka.
Woo, baby! That's what I'm talking about.
I think was it Guillermo del Toro pronounces it Jovanka? I think that's how he pronounces it.
Yeah, that's how everybody else around Kentucky pronounces it, too. Hey, Jovanka!
Come on,
get down here!
Jovanka! So, but, man, we appreciate you calling. It looks like you'd probably be the last caller, because it is... It's getting kind
of
late, I guess.
Yeah, and thanks a lot, though, for the praise of the documentary and stuff. I mean,
I have one question for you guys, though. This is interesting. Do you think Fangoria will ever get their hands on it?
No.
No? Not at all?
I would be very surprised.
Here's what I think. I think that there are some people in that organization that probably, like, well, I know there is, because just talking to Debbie Rashawn, that, like, closet listen to the show, so they might get it. But I guarantee nobody in the up-and-up, like, upper echelon is going to give a shit about it at all. So.
Well, I think he's asking if they'll cover it at all.
Oh, if they'll cover it? No. Fuck no.
Well, here's the thing, though. I mean, I think the power has sort of changed hands over there a little bit. I've heard that Tony Timpone now is more like a puppet. Well, I mean, he was probably a puppet before, but I mean, he's just like a figure now,
and
you know, since their bankruptcy, they're in sort of, you know, there's new reigns, I guess.
You got all the key words into that one sentence. Tony Timpone's puppet, bankruptcy. You got like all the shit you could into that.
But I mean, if something, we don't have anything in the documentary itself about Fangoria, so I guess that's good for them maybe covering it, but I seriously doubt it. It has deadpit.com in the title, and they sort of know we're not fans of theirs anymore. So,
but what if it explodes around Fangoria, and there's just like absolutely nothing they can do? Like if they try to stop that chain reaction by not covering it, it makes them look like a bunch of damn fools.
I gotta admit, it would be great if it sort of blew up like American Movie, and they invited us to go to like, you know, the late show with Conan O'Brien or whatever, and then we could, like, publicly badmouth Fangoria on that show. That would be awesome.
It's like the culmination of a dream.
There's nothing they can do.
Yeah. Of course, again, when you'd mention it on Conan O'Brien, like, half the audience would be like, what the fuck's a Fangoria?
That's true. Nobody would probably know what we're talking about except us. It'd be worth
it. It might take a little bit of, like, you know, the wind out of your sails of victory. I'm just saying.
We'll just have
to
wait.
But anyway,
I'll
let you guys go. Actually,
you dropped your phone or something?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, I had some actually like serious questions that I think Kelly wanted me to ask you guys, but I don't have them on me, so I'll save those for another call.
We all know Kelly likes to be super serious.
Yeah, Kelly's using you as like a mediator for us now.
They were hard hitting questions journalistically.
I'm sure
it was gonna be like an edition of Hard Copy. Mm-hmm. You guys remember that '90s show?
Oh yeah,
it was exactly almost as good as Sidings.
Yeah, or Inside Edition.
I guess that's. I haven't watched the news in like a decade, so have to forgive me.
Well, you need to check out Katie Couric, buddy.
Buddy,
I hear good things about her.
Yeah.
I hear she's going places.
Fuck Katie Couric. Check out Robin Meade. Golly.
Yeah, that's morning news, though. You have to get up pretty early.
That's
to
true,
see
but
her.
She's dirty over 30.
Okay.
We miss Lori Do, though. Did you ever see Lori Do on Fox News? That was like the hottest, man. I think they got rid of her.
What's up with Fox News using like porn stars for news anchors now?
Who knows?
That's a genius.
But, man, yeah, we will let you go, but we appreciate you calling in. Appreciate all the kind words about the documentary and everything, and just thanks for all the support and stuff over the last few months.
Yeah. You guys owe me a lot. I mean,
I know. You know, I know we do.
I've had fun doing it. It's been cool writing basically the same article many times over. No, it has been fun. I've enjoyed it. And, I'll talk to you guys later.
All right. We'll see you, man.
Take care,
guys. So, yeah, since it is almost 9 o'clock, I don't think anybody else is going to call.
No, nobody's going to call.
So let's go through these fan questions at lightning speed from Kyle Reese. He says, have you guys ever considered interviewing Brian Usna? His name has been tossed around the show a few times. I'd love to hear you guys interview him, and as he's a really nice guy, he's been involved in some really strange slash terrific films. His first film, Society, I think we watched that. That movie's not too good. Did we watch that
I don't one? Think we did, no.
It's a truly bizarre movie, and I had the luck of finding it for $5 at a flea market. I highly recommend checking that out, especially for fans of practical effects. He was also involved in all the Reanimators in some respect and directed Return of Living Dead 3, Silent Night, Deadly Night 4, which is god-awful.
Shut your damn mouth.
Buddy, fuck you. That's that one movie with Bill Moseley in it and had that fucking thing on his head.
What are you sure that was 4? I thought that was 3. You better watch out.
What the fuck was 4 then?
I don't know. 5 was the Toy Maker. Maybe 4 was...
I think 4 was the one with... Fuck, I don't know. Did we ever see 4? Maybe 4 is the one we haven't seen.
I don't think
yet.
We've seen 4. 4 might be The Initiation or something like that.
But he did The Dentist 1 and 2, which, yeah.
Hey, here's the thing. Like, I would love to interview Brian Usna because I actually really like Return of the Living Dead 3 and I like The Dentist, amazingly. And he's done, like, production work for, like, a ton of stuff, too. I think Reanimator was another one that he had a hand in producing and directing in a lot of those films. But he's in Spain. That's the main problem.
He's really a Spaniard. He's in Spain.
That I see with doing that interview. I think maybe if we could catch him sometime in L.A. I know he's got an office in L.A. as well. We could do it then. But I don't think most of the time he's got a place called the Fantastic Factory or something like that in Spain. So that'd be kind of hard to do.
It's in Spain City, Spain.
It is. this is a pretty good question. I don't think we've ever been asked this, but Jason 8 writes in and says, my question is, if you could have any car you've seen in a horror movie, what would it be? He says, if I had to pick, I'd go with Reggie's Black Barracuda from the Phantasm series. He says, by the way, thanks for the show and long live VHS.
Actually, the original vehicle, I think it was a Hemi Cuda, 1971. That was Jody's in the original Phantasm. Reggie, for some reason, I don't know if he inherited it or what in the sequels. It was Reggie's car in the sequels, but it was Jody's in the, the character was named Jody, wasn't it? Bill Thornberry's character, I think it was Jody.
Jody?
I would agree with you on that. I mean, I'm not a big car person, but to me, that's a badass fucking car up there.
There's only a couple more I can think of that I really thought was as cool as that one. The one from the Monster Squad, of course. The
hearse.
The hearse thing. And Tom Atkins' car in Night of the Creeps. I don't know what model that was, like a 50s model car, one of the older ones, but that was always a really cool car.
And what was the car in Christine? We can mention that. Is it a Fury or something like that?
I have no idea. I'm like the least car person ever.
Yeah.
I don't even...
I occasionally watch like the Barrett Jackson car auction, but... Like, yeah, I'm about the same way. I think the car in the Wraith was pretty cool, too, though.
Oh, God, I forgot about that. The fucking Wraith over here.
That was a real car, too. I don't remember what the name of it was, but you can look it up online.
It was a Wraithster.
Yeah, that's what it was. Clean Tone asks, end of the pit related question. Do you know and can you say how many copies were made of the first pressing of End of the Pit? Now, here's the thing, and I'm going to stand by this because we've sort of agreed to this. That was the only pressing of the work print of End of the Pit. If you didn't get in on it, I have no clue when the final version will be out. We're going to seek distribution, or Kelly's going to seek distribution and see what kind of deals he can get at these film festivals for it. As far as the number of copies we sold, I know we initially started with 100, but I think the initial run sold out within something like 6 hours. And he said, wait up until like 11 on the Friday and then just end it. And then I'll make up all the rest of the copies. So I have no idea about the exact amount of copies that were sold. It was over 100 though, I know that.
Yeah. And for that matter, like, that'll be the only 100 of those that ever get made, of course, but they're gone completely.
Yeah, and when the posters are gone, those are gone for good as well. I mean, that's not the final poster art either, by the way. It's going to be altered a little bit from that, the final version of
that. So if you got one of those, you consider yourself really, really lucky, because they went like fucking crazy on that one day. So
yeah, I was surprised myself. I was thinking, well, maybe we'll sell them all by the next Friday. I had no clue they would all be gone the fucking that day, you know. And Kaylee was sort of calling, freaking out, because at first I hadn't added the shipping on there and shit. And it was like, there's no damn way I'm paying $70 to ship all these DVDs.
Yeah, I can see that, actually.
So I had to straighten that up. He was just, I think he was really surprised that we sold that many as well. But, yeah, I mean, I was sort of definitely taken back by the amount of discs that we went through last week, for sure.
So, next question, though. Since the commentary at Friday Night Film Fest didn't happen, do you think you guys will do a commentary of Home Sweet Home? I'd really love to hear your thoughts about this forgotten slasher. This is from Rick of the Dead. Well, the thing about that is that's only on VHS, isn't it? I mean, that'd be kind of hard to...
I think there's like a Canadian bootleg DVD.
But the point of that, doing those commentaries, is so that somebody would be able to have the DVD. And you know, there's not a lot of people that's going to have a Canadian DVD copy.
Mm.
I'd love to do it, though.
Yeah, I think maybe that's one of those deals we can do that and sell that as a DVD at a convention or something.
Yeah, that's just a movie that's way too hilarious to ignore. It's got so much random, like, stupid shit in it. Like the guy that has the guitar with the amplifier on his back that walks around. Like, you have to see it to even really understand and appreciate that.
Yeah, and our good buddy Crater is concerned about who would win in an ass-fucking contest. Would it be George Vanilla or Mike Knotts? Uncle Bill, who do you think would win in an ass-fucking contest?
I can't
believe
you even put that question in there, to be honest. That's one of those questions.
Why not?
I don't
know.
Crater
wants to know. He wants to find out who the best ass-fucker is so he can bend right down and get fucked by him.
I honestly don't have any idea. I don't have any comment on that question at all.
So let's get on to a serious question. Reprobate says, I've seen and owned a lot of the so-called video nasties, films like Cannibal, Fur Ox, Maniac, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and I've even seen more recent ones like Martyrs, Inside Frontiers, and Seed. What are some of your favorite nasty films, and why would you recommend them? Thanks for a great show, guys, and keep it coming.
Hmm.
Nasty movies, Uncle Bill. Movies that are brutal.
Nasty movies. I'm not even sure how to take that question. Really nasty films that I would recommend.
I'll tell you one that's fucking nastier than shit is that movie Necromantic 2 that we watched.
Yeah, the baby seal clubbing and skinning is always a nice touch in any film. I'm going to go with the Ilsa series, actually, because I think those movies would fit into that category, and I like all of them. So,
yeah, and there's, like, I think that movies like that are for a different audience. I mean, not all horror fans are into the cannibal movies and just the straight-out gore movies. But there's a separate audience that just goes for that stuff.
There's
like
a whole
Deodato and Umberto Lenzi and all the Fulci gore movies and stuff like that. Like, people think Cat in the Brain is like one of the best gory movies ever made. Like, I have no idea why. But I mean, there's an audience for all that stuff out there, and I like some of those movies. Those movies are fun to watch on occasion. But I've found that, like, they're not really movies I go back and watch a lot. I mean, Cannibal Holocaust is probably the one exception. Just because I think there's something else to that movie other than the gore, for me at least. It's just, I don't know, it's really well constructed.
If you want to get into it, there's a whole subgenre of films about corpse fucking. You can go see, like, Lucker the Necrophagist and Necromantic, and there's movies just about that and that alone, so... I don't know. I don't get into those movies like that, but there is a subgenre like that for just about every single thing you can think of.
Yeah. But, I mean, as far as favorites, like, I would probably say Cannibal Holocaust. Cannibal Ferox is pretty good, too. We were talking about Mountain of the Cannibal God before. What else? The Fulci zombie movies, you know, Cat in the Brain,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. There you go.
All Italian films, basically, around that time period of the late 70s, early 80s. Okay, let's see.
Oh, my Lord, who's next on here?
Alexander writes in and says, knowing what y'all know now, if you could go back and start the Dead Pit Kingdom over, including the show, the board, merchandise, what would be the one thing you all would do differently?
I was thinking more about this. There's a lot of things I'd do differently, actually. See, one, I would have fired that motherfucker that did our t-shirts a long goddamn time ago and got Joe from Fast Custom. Well, I didn't know of Joe until about a year ago, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Got him to do the shirts, because that motherfucker, he lives by his name. He a fast son of a bitch. He gets his stuff done quick. What else? I know you've got
I would initially have been a lot harder on people on the board than we were. Like, I know we talked a long time about, like, trying to let the board kind of go and run by itself, and that just turned into, like, one of the biggest messes ever. So I probably wouldn't have done that the same.
Yeah. I would have banned Dr. Blood long ago as well. I mean, that sort of goes with it.
I'll tell you another thing.
We were starting, I mean, it was starting to get to the point where that guy started a thread, post your poop here. Posting photos of his daily shits on there.
He thought that was funny and clever somehow. Another thing I would have done, as I would have never have reviewed four films a week.
Yeah.
Like, I would have done just, because that almost single-handedly, like, burnt me out on horror films forever, I think, at one point. Like, it just got to be such a pain in the ass to watch that much stuff every week that I would have never done that.
Yeah, I think that we now, I don't even know if we're going to do this October, but every October we said we're going to start back with the four a week. I don't know if we can do that now. I mean, we might try it and see, because there's just so much stuff that comes out in that month. You pretty much have to do that or send the real good stuff out to review, written reviews. We don't like doing that, do we?
No, we don't like it. As far as the show itself goes, I really wouldn't change anything about the show. I mean, it kind of had to evolve through, like, the first couple of shows and stuff to what it is now.
I wish I'd, and this only goes back a few months, I wish I'd never got that cunt, Jeremy Dreyfuss, to try to get her to do an interview. Fucking bitch.
Yeah. This is strong feelings, though.
Another fucking cunt I wish we'd never wasted our DVDs on, that bitch Dark Pumpkin.
You know, I completely forgotten about her. And Tim, like, brought her up over the course of the Friday Night Film Fest. I didn't even remember her. Like, she's been blanked out of my memory. Yeah. But yeah.
I can remember one time, though, she pissed us off so bad by not doing those reviews. We gave out her own phone number on the show.
Give her a call. Tell her she's a cunt.
I'm sure somebody did that, too. It makes me happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I got to say about all that.
So, yeah. I guess that's good enough. Bo Davis, I guess that's the last question. Says, hey, fellas, long-time poster, first-time poster, long-time listener. Says, a lot of my favorite horror movies tend to be on the comedic side. Stuff like Dead Alive, Blood Diner. He put Blood Dinner, but it's Blood Diner. Evil Dead 2 and Shaun of the Dead. I was wondering if you might be able to suggest some more movies in this genre that maybe indies are just plain overlooked. Thanks for giving me the years and years worth of horror talk goodness, and here's to many more.
Cheers. Shit, dude. I can recommend you like 1,000 of those movies. You got stuff like Monsterd, which is great. You've got Slime City, which is awesome in that same vein as stuff like Street Trash and stuff like that. Good Lord, anything from like Trauma in the early to mid 80s I thought was really good. Class of Nukem High and stuff like that.
I think the stuff that I always go for is shit that was unintentionally funny.
Fat Ethel.
Yeah, and we were talking about Home Sweet Home earlier. Like, there's all kinds of stuff, and that just makes you roll your fucking eyes, you know, in that movie. And
Night Train to Terror.
Yeah.
That's one that's, like, unintentionally fucking hilarious.
Yeah, the song. Everybody's got something to do. Everybody but you. So dance with me, dance with me. Come on and dance with me, dance with me.
Yeah. check that out, though.
Good one.
Good Lord, what else? Independent stuff that was really good and funny. Hmm. Oh, of course, hack movie stuff. And pretty much I love and even
low-budget pictures.
Yeah, I was going to say low-budget pictures, even though the guys from Hack Movies would probably smack the shit out of me for saying that. I do like them.
Yeah.
Well, somebody's calling at fucking 9:30.
You won't take it or not?
No, I don't want to fucking take it.
I don't either. I'm a little tired. Sorry. 859 area code. I don't know who you are. You probably know who you are if you listen to this. It's too late, folks. We've been on here. This show is going to be 3 hours long. No shit. So, that's it, though. We're going to take a break. We will be back. We've got DVD reviews to get to. A couple of announcements. Not a whole lot of stuff. But we will be back here on DeadPit.com.
What began as a vacation ended as a nightmare. The hills have eyes.
That was a bad mistake.
The hills have eyes. The story of an American family who lost everything except the will to survive. The hills have eyes.
Hi, this is Tom Savini, and you're listening to DeadBit.com. Aren't you lucky?
Well, welcome back to Dead Pit. I'm a Creepy Kentucky.
And I am, of course, Uncle Bill.
And big thanks for everybody that called in earlier. I know there's a bunch of people that tried when we were on there with Jeff. But we definitely wanted to promote the Scarefest and get that out there, because that's going to be a huge show, Uncle Bill. I mean, I know as far as, like, you know, a lot of these people we've met before, but for that area, that's going to be huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about location, 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 and that's a great place to have a horror show or any kind of show, really. It's like just completely in downtown Lexington, surrounded by all the businesses and stuff. Great location.
And we're going to see what we can do about making Tucky Williams a future lovely lady of Dead Pit.
Tucky, Tucky, Tucky now.
We want her, baby. We want her on a Dead Pit
team. Tucky, Tucky, Tucky now. Tucky, Tucky.
Maybe that's who was trying to call in.
That's what I said. It could be Tucky Williams.
I'm fine if it was Tucky. Just let us know. We'll call you back.
Somebody's calling from the Lexington area code, but we weren't able to get it.
Yeah, but we apologize for that. Just call in next week. I will be here. I don't think Uncle Bill will be here next week.
No, he'll I know I won't be here next
busy
week.
Busy fist fucking himself to death. But a few announcements we need to make before we get into the reviews. We do have a couple of new videos up that we've been working on, and about our collections that we've updated since the Fright Night Film Fest. I guess I call them the Fright Night Film Fest scores for 2009, so it has a bunch of our memorabilia and crap that we grabbed at this show a couple weeks ago.
That's right. It's a two-part video because there was so much shit in it that we had to separate it because it's like 40 minutes long. So you should already see the first part. It's up on YouTube right now.
It's insane.
And you should be getting the second part by the time this
it's
is
crazy.
Up.
It's crazy.
So it should be off the chain insane.
And also, we need to let everybody know that I believe Dead Pit on the Road returns at some point this weekend with a video review.
Oh, yeah, it has to, because Halloween 2 is coming out, and there's no way in hell I'm going to miss that. That just looks like a goddamn train wreck.
People wondering, when the fuck y'all going to do another On the Road? I guess the Madman Georgetown Drive-In thing didn't count for a lot of people.
Oh, it'll count because it'll be on the next DVD. I guarantee that. Yeah.
Well, we're in pre-production for season 2 right now. That'll be out hopefully around Halloween.
We still got to do a lot of casting choices and stuff, though.
So we'll be doing that. We'll also be back for Saturday Nightmares, which was a huge show last week. It was a fun show, too.
Over 50 people were in that chat last time, which is pretty amazing.
You know something I was thinking, too? Our good buddy Jason Triple X bought an extra poster and DVD to give away. So I'm thinking we might ought to give that away on Saturday Nightmares this week.
That's right. He actually bought a poster and a DVD for one fan. He bought it out of his own money to to give it away to somebody else who might not have been lucky enough to get in on it, and he's lucky that he did, actually.
So it's all gone as far as to buy the DVD. We'll have one more copy to give away on Saturday Nightmares, Uncle Bill. We're going to give it away.
Ooh, daddy.
So with that, let's get in to the DVDs.
So first up here, we've got a little joint directed by John Newland and put out by the Warner Archive Collection, which is Warner Brothers' new collection. You can only order this shit via the Warner Archive Collection, I think, at warnerarchive.com.
That's right.
This is Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
That's another one of the more well-known direct-to-TV movies from the 70s. There's a ton of these. I think this is one of the early ones. This is from 73, I think.
Yeah. Kim Darby, Jim Hutton, Barbara Anderson, a whole lot of other motherfuckers are in this one.
I'm a big fan of Jim Hutton.
Yeah. So, what we got here is Kim Darby and her husband move into this new house. He's like a business executive guy who works way too hard, and she's feeling like she doesn't really have that close of a relationship to him, so they move into this new house.
She pretty much just sits her ass at the house.
She does, apparently.
Lazy bitch.
And within, like, first couple of weeks, initially stuff's going fine, and she starts to notice that things are misplaced, like keys from the door and stuff have been misplaced. And then she starts to see, like, shadows out of the corner of her eye and just different stuff like that. Until finally culminating, and she starts to hear voices of things talking to her. In particular, saying things like, "We're going to get you next."
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So she starts to freak out, and she tells her husband about what's going on. And, of course, nobody believes her.
Everybody thinks she's nutty.
Yeah.
And eventually you get a closer glimpse at these creatures, and it really starts turning into a cheese fest when you see the I guess they're demons.
I don't know what the hell they are. What they're supposed to be, really.
They're midgets in these little monster costumes, okay? And they take, like, perspective shots, trying to make them look a lot smaller than they really are. And it doesn't work in this movie at all. I mean, to me, it didn't. As far as the, you know, larger sets for the midgets and stuff like that, it just looked, and the thing is, like, the demons or the monsters or whatever and the humans are never seen together on the same screen throughout the whole movie.
These things are basically like little gremlins, though. They go around and they cause havoc. They break stuff. They move stuff around. They trip people. Like, there's one guy that comes over. I think he's like an artist. And they string a line across the steps and trip him, and he falls down the steps. And, you know, Kim Darby realizes at some point that there are these things there. And there's another guy in the film, this is probably my favorite part of the film. There's always a character like this who's like the crotchety old caretaker that knows what's going on, and he tries to warn them, you know, to not laugh at things that they don't understand and all this stuff.
Yeah, but he won't tell them exactly because he's scared that the monsters will start coming for him.
That's right. And they do. So, they come after him.
Yeah, this movie is really, really low budget, of course. And the effects are extremely dated for today's movies, to say the least. I mean, this is a movie. This is like nearly 37 years old. So, I thought the movie, especially compared to other made-for-TV horror films in the 1970s, such as Crawl Space and Bad Ronald and one we talked about earlier, Devil Dog, Hound of Hell. This one, I don't know. I mean, this was like definitely my least favorite of those movies. I can see, I guess, if you were a kid growing up in that time frame watching this movie, I can see why you would like it, just because it is a movie, it's a horror movie really made sort of for kids, I guess, and something that your parents would have let you watch when you were a little tyke running around. And I can see how, you know, if you grew up with the movie, how you would enjoy it now for nostalgic purposes, sort of like we do with, you know, Monster Squad and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's got that feeling that where if you were to watch it when you were a kid, you probably would remember some of the scenes in it just because they're so out there. And it does have like a very mysterious vibe to the film. But to me, it played out kind of like, even though it was before Tales from the Dark Side, like a really extended Tales from the Dark Side episode with a really bad ending. Like there really is no ending to this movie. It just, it kind of just warns me that it just ends.
Abruptly ends.
Yeah.
And the end sequence, they don't even really show you, too, is why it doesn't work. But I don't know. I think this movie belongs in every horror fan's collection. Just because I've heard of this movie for years, and this is the first time I'd seen it. A lot of people do consider it a classic of the era, you know. So it's cool that Warner finally came out with this in some form. I know a lot of people are sort of upset that it's just a direct to transfer, like DVD transfer, and they don't have any special features on it or anything like that. What do you think of the transfer on this DVD?
It's okay. I didn't think it was as bad as the Bad Ronald transfer, actually. But I mean, it just kind of looks like a little bit better than a first generation VHS transfer. I mean, probably like one of the better VHS transfers.
Yeah, because you got to remember this movie is from 73, so and it was a TV movie at that, and they didn't have a whole lot of money for those back then. So I think it looked okay. I mean, it was definitely the whole movie. A lot of movies from the 70s like that have this cloudy look about them, you know, hue to them, I guess. So
Kim Darby was off the chain in it, though. I'm a big Kim Darby.
It didn't really look like Kim Darby, though, did it?
No.
She was really young in this.
She got a real bad case of the satchel ass really early on.
Yeah. Oh, God. So, but as far as Warner Archive, I mean, this is the second DVD and probably the last one we review for a while from this collection. I'm sort of warming up to the idea because a lot of this, like, what kind of extras would they have for this shit now anyway, really? I mean,
I have no idea. Maybe an introspective commentary with Kim Darby. That'd be awesome.
They could get her away from, like, painting dick holes or whatever the hell she's doing now.
Kim Darby's a fucking weird woman. Have you ever noticed that now?
Yeah, if you go to her website.
It seems like she was seemingly pretty normal in films like this, and I think she was in True Grit and stuff as well. I don't know what happened around the era that she was in, like, Halloween 6 and Teen Wolf 2 and all that stuff. She just got fucking weird.
Maybe all the LSD she did in the early days.
But yeah, as far as this movie goes, unless you watch this when you're a kid and you really have a love for this movie, I don't know. I don't even know if I would recommend you buy it. I'd probably recommend you can't rent it anywhere. You have to buy it.
Yeah, you pretty much have to buy it. Yeah. That's the deal. I think they have a deal like you can get 5 of these for $50, 5 of these Warner Archives. So if you just keep checking the list and, you know, I know they're going to be coming out with a lot more of this stuff later on. So maybe you eventually find 5 that you want.
Yeah, if you like this type of movie where it kind of it looks like a, you know, a TV show or has that feel to it of the 70s, then you might want to pick this up. But as a movie, just in and of itself, it's just
cheap.
Not very good. Yeah,
really cheap. It's really cheap.
But go over to WarnerArchive.com and check these out. Check out the whole archive collection.
Right. So the last DVD set we're going to be talking about is from WWE Home Video, and Uncle Bill bought this just so nobody will fucking email us and ask us where.
Oh God, who the hell did you fucking contact to get this free shit?
WWE sends us stuff. This man likes us.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. Like whenever we get like a new company or something sending us stuff, we always get at least 5 or 6 people email us.
Where's the contact info at?
You ain't getting it. That's where it's at.
Yeah. So, Rise and Fall WCW, what we're going to do pretty much, I mean, they have 3 discs in this. The other 2 discs are all matches. So I guess the thing that we should really review is the documentary itself, which runs 1 hour and 45 or so minutes. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of the horror fans aren't going to be into this, but there's a lot of fans I've noticed that like the wrestling. And we haven't. I've been waiting ever since I saw this last night to talk about this because I am so surprised at how well of a job the rival WWE did and how fair they were throughout this entire documentary. I mean, Vince even said himself in the documentary that once WCW folded, they weren't happy, you know. I mean, it was just another day for them. It was business, you know. They got a really, really good deal for the... I think that the... I'd heard that the library, they got all the NWA and WCW tapes for something like $2 million. All of it. You know, that's insane.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think that the fall of WCW is probably one of the worst things that ever happened to wrestling.
Yeah.
Ever. Because ever since then, my God, like WWE's just steadily gotten worse and worse.
Yeah. But the documentary itself really follows, like, it starts from scratch pretty much. Jim Crockett Sr., who started the NWA or, you know, helped start the NWA with a group of promoters, and it moved on to his sons who ran NWA through all of, you know, when they finally sold to Ted Turner, through all of the pieces of shit they got to run the company up until Eric Bischoff finally got it to work a little bit. And then, like, they really... To me, when it really started getting good is when Eric Bischoff comes into the picture and everyone talks about the idea of bringing in Hulk Hogan to WCW and how that, like, the ideas of turning him heel at the Bash of the Beach 96 and forming the NWO and how that awesome idea, that one great idea that Bischoff had, ultimately is what killed the business. I mean, those, especially Kevin Nash, from what they say, I mean, he was the lead booker after a point. And I thought from that point on, I was really interested in it from that point on. But I thought the whole documentary was really good. I mean, I love watching stuff like this.
I was going to say, though, I actually liked the first part of the documentary better than the shit where it gets into Bischoff stuff, because I guess I didn't know that much about how WCW actually got started and how, you know, it came from the NWA and Georgia Championship Wrestling and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, there was a really cool thing that I didn't even know about, that Vince McMahon bought Georgia Championship Wrestling and was on TBS for a brief period.
Yeah.
They had the footage of that. And then they sort of just, because it was a handshake deal, they didn't have any contracts. Ted Turner sort of kicked him off, and that's what sort of kick-started their feud a little bit. And I thought that was really interesting as well. Like I said, I mean, the whole thing was really well put together, and I think it was fair to everybody involved. I mean, like, they didn't really pull any... I think, well, with a few people, they may have been a little cruel, like Vince Russo and Jeff Jarrett. Let's be honest. I mean, when Vince Russo came... to power in the dying days of WCW, man, it was already so far gone anyway. Like, I wouldn't blame it solely on that guy. I mean, it did get worse.
Well, there are people, even in this documentary, that still believe that Vince Russo really was like a plant.
Yeah.
And came over there to destroy the company.
But people need to realize, though, at that point, it was already dead, pretty much. I mean, it was already... Because I remember those days. I mean, they brought him in late, I think, 99, early 2000. And the company itself, I don't know if there was any saving that company, because that was right around the time where they pulled the, you know, Kevin Nash pulled the shit-beating Goldberg.
Yeah.
For no really, and it really become nothing, because the next night, Hogan got the title back by just, you know, pushing Nash over and pinning him, you know.
Another thing they didn't talk about on here, though, that was just as big of a part of it as the stuff with Goldberg, I thought, was the way they mishandled the whole Sting shit. Like, right. To me, that was just as disappointing as what they did with Goldberg. They hyped Sting up for fucking years and years, fighting for that match, you know. And...
Well, they were sort of handicapped with that because Sting works for TNA. I mean, that's probably why they didn't do it. They didn't talk about it much.
Did Sting work for TNA back then?
No, he's working for them now. That's why they ain't going to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did talk about, I mean, Sting was in there a couple of different times. They didn't.
Yeah, they mentioned Sting, but I mean, I don't think it was one, they didn't really want to focus solely on him. Although I did hear that they tried to contact him to participate in the video, which I think he can do that, but he turned them down because they didn't have like some sort of agreement with TNA at the time or something, but he did turn them down. They asked a bunch of people to participate in this.
Well, there's a bunch of people that aren't in it that's like very noticeable. I guess Hall and Nash being the two biggest ones.
I'm surprised it didn't get Hall. What the fuck's he doing?
Nothing. As far as I can tell, he's no showing at TNA events. Luger's not in there, but I'd say it was probably for health reasons. Of course, Sting's not there.
They use like Hall and Bischoff and Hogan and Archive stuff.
Yeah, like 2003, 2004 stuff.
But they do have like Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Magnum TA, which is pretty cool to see him again. They have like Cowboy Bill Watts, which I was surprised that they got his ass. Both of the Crockett brothers. Who else? They had a bunch of people behind the scenes. Jim Ross, of course.
Goldberg. They had a new interview with Goldberg on there.
Yeah, I was surprised at that as well. What I was surprised about Kevin is how much Goldberg seemed to know about the fucking wrestling business. Like that was a little bit of a shock.
I tell you, the one guy that really stood out for me, I wish they would have given him more FaceTime, was Jericho, because he was the guy that he was just fucking... You could tell that whole situation, he hated
the
whole situation with WCW, really.
Well, Dean Malenko did. I think he was really good on it, too. I guess the reason, though, that I like the Bischoff stuff is I remember all that shit. I remember when it happened, and it was kind of cool to go back and see. You know, because a lot of us now, of course, we miss WCW because there's no competition. And competition's always a good thing, whether or not, you know, the last few years of WCW it blew ass. But it's always good to have somebody else there because it's good. I mean, it's good competition to have back and forth shit going on. And what I thought was interesting about it, too, is how much stuff today... You know, is WCW and Eric Bischoff responsible for? I mean, you got to remember, before Nitro, Raw was only live once a month after a pay-per-view or once every 2 months. And it was only an hour long, you know. And because of Nitro, Raw is live every week. It really is, I mean, and 2 hours long, you know. And another thing, which probably isn't a good thing, WCW was the first company, I believe, to do 12 pay-per-views a year.
Now, what does WWE do? They do about 20.
It seems they were the first ones to do pay-per-views every month. I know WWF at the time was doing the in-your-house stuff, but that wasn't every month. That was occasional. So they're responsible for a lot of the success, I think, in WWE and what they've had over the years. People don't really talk about that much either.
Yeah, and looking back on it, too, I think that... there's some things in here, though, that just, they take credit for WCW where there really wasn't any credit. I think the one that got to me was the whole Lucha Libre stuff and the Japanese wrestlers and stuff like that, where WCW's talking about how fucking innovative they were. That was ECW shit there. I mean, they borrowed that idea off ECW.
That's true, but for a lot of people, ECW didn't exist because they didn't get it, you know.
I know, but you know that now. I mean, everybody pretty much knows that if you know anything about ECW.
Yeah, but you got to give Eric Bischoff credit in that he was smart enough to see that those guys were awesome and brought them to a national level then. I mean, of course, I'm sure that's what he saw them on is ECW because all these guys pretty much were in ECW or in one of the big Japan federations at the time.
But anyway, as far as this DVD goes, it goes through the first Starrcade, talking about why it is they set up the first pay-per-view and how that came to be and all that stuff. The New World Order, of course, gets its own segment, but probably not as long a segment as it should have. Of course, all the different managers and shit that they went through during that whole time, Bill Watts, the Shea guy, Jim Hurd. There's like a ton of fuckers. It was like a revolving door.
Yeah, I can't even remember all of them. They were a bunch of hacks, pretty much.
I
think the Jim Hurd era was what we were watching the other night, Halloween Havoc 91. That was Jim Hurd.
That guy was a genius. the final night of WCW, which I think everybody that ever watches wrestling will remember that when Shane shows up. And
yeah, that was really memorable. And
it is good, though. It's a good documentary. I wish that they would have been able to get some of those guys and talk to them more up to date in like 2003 or 2004, but they had enough people in there that knew what was going on behind the scenes to fill up those places.
I think Mike Graham was another really good one. Yeah. That he was behind the scenes in WCW for a while, and they got him. And yeah, I mean, there was a lot of really good stuff in this. Hour and 45 minutes long. It seemed like it flew by. But so if you're a wrestling fan, this is like, what, $20 at Walmart or something like
yeah.
that?
And we didn't talk about this, but it does have like 20 matches on it, too, as well as the documentary. It's 9 hours of footage.
Yeah, and really looking back at it now, I mean, it's been over 8 years since WCW folded. And I think the wrestling, especially like in the last 4 or 5 years, has just seemed to really, really go down the shitter. And it needs competition, you know. And the sad thing is, like, I don't know where the hell that competition is going to come from. A lot of people say it's UFC, but I mean, that's really a different beast itself.
Yeah. It's not. I can tell you this, and I know there's a lot of people that like these two. But in my opinion, the competition is not going to be TNA or Ring of Honor. That's just not going to be
it. Hello. TNA is a glorified independent wrestling promotion. It's really what it is.
Yeah. Kurt Angle's busy chasing around Rock a Con.
Doesn't become any more evident if you go to one of those house shows and they have Polaroid pictures you can take with wrestlers for $20. That's exactly what they do when you go and see the Rock and Roll Express, you know, at the local elementary school.
Come on out here and get your
picture. I'll get your picture taken with Rock and Roll Express in the rain, kids.
Yeah, so they're not competition. And Jeff Jarrett, yeah, I love what they were saying about Jeff Jarrett.
Never drawed a dime. That's true. It is. Jeff Jarrett's one of those guys that's even worse than Luger. I mean, Luger was a lot more over any time than Jeff Jarrett ever was.
Well, Luger at least had a physique about him. I mean, he looked like a superstar, whether or not he could do anything or not.
That's true. There's just certain guys, though, like him, that they try and try to push, and that they just cannot get over for whatever reason. Yeah.
And from what I understand, Jeff Jarrett's a real arrogant motherfucker, too. Like, he really does think he's a superstar.
What the shit? Yeah, buddy, you can break your cardboard guitars off of a fucking your dick hole or something.
Oh!
So, that is it. That's the rise and fall of WCW. I liked it quite a bit. I had fun watching it.
I don't think it's as good as the rise and fall of ECW, though, because I think the only reason I liked that so much was Paul Heyman. Like, you didn't have a guy, you didn't have the Bischoff in this one to say, like, what needed to be said.
Yeah, love y'all!
Well, I mean, really, you need the guy that was behind the scenes on all that stuff and that made the decisions to be on there as well. That's what was so great about that DVD.
I highly recommend this one, though. Rise and Fall WCW.
I do, too, just because it's cheap. It's got an hour and 45-minute documentary and 9 hours of matches on it. You got to get it.
So that is it for this week. We appreciate everybody taking the phone calls, talking horror with us. We'll be back next week. I don't know what the fuck we're doing again, but it really doesn't matter, does it?
No, it never does.
The interesting thing was, people don't get this. That show last week was more popular than the last two shows we had with interviews. I don't know if you realize that or not.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we don't need no interviews. Whole fucking show.
But, thank you guys once again for tuning in. And, big thanks, of course, to everybody that bought Into the Pit last week as well. I mean, we sold out of that in record time, I think.
Yeah, and thanks to everybody that will for sure be buying the posters that we still have left in the near future.
Go buy them right now. They're cheap.
Buy some stuff.
They're sort of cheap. So we will be back next week with some sort of show. We'll just say that. So we'll see you then. And until then, keep tuning in to Dead Bit.
Dot com.